Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we watched season 2, episode 4, titled Garden of Bones, not too long ago.
You know, we did. We did.
I watched it twice, as a matter of fact.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Just because you fell asleep in the first time? Or
no. Wants to make my outline, wants to color it in, let's say. Fill in the stuff between the descriptions of the scenes.
Did you stay within the lines?
Mostly, yeah.
All right.
I follow the rules pretty much.
Well, that sounds boring.
Yeah, what'd you think of this episode?
I thought it was better than our tortured metaphor for watching and podcasting the episode. I like it. I think this is like, I forgot about this part of peak Tyrion. Like I thought we'd, you know, we're going to have to resort to fracking to get the rest of the peak Tyrion out from the marrow of the season. And, like, you know, our engineers win another 50 feet, another gusher of peak Tyrion comes flying out. His utter destruction of Lancel is amazing. Him coming in and fucking cutting Joffrey's dick off at court, amazing. Mm-hmm. And Papa Lannister comes back. We're graced with Tywin putting his own smack down on a bunch of incompetent, murderous lackeys. It's I liked it. I liked it.
Yeah, it's, I guess, been a while since we've seen Tywin.
Yeah, yeah.
Have we seen him in season 2? I don't even remember.
I don't think so. Last time we saw him, he was given Tyrion his walking papers, or his marching papers, rather.
Mm-hmm.
I also think this is notable because it's one of those episodes that really expands our world. Like, not since Dany miraculously survived the fire have we seen, you know, something this like, holy shit, this is a game changer, such as Melisandre giving birth to the shadow baby for purposes unknown.
Yeah.
But it's another, like, this is the first kind of, one of the first curveballs the show throws at the people who are attracted to the House of Cards aspect of the goings on here at Game of Thrones. Like, I've never seen Frank do that. What do you think?
Yeah, I largely agree. I really enjoyed this episode. I find myself cringing at some things because I know what's coming up for some of these characters. This being the nature of the rewatch, but other than that, like, it's not any worse for that. It's just like, oh man, why are you making some of the decisions you're making, people?
Right.
But yeah, ultimately, it's really good. And like you said, Tyrion's always a pleasure to watch. I actually think that Tywin is a pleasure to watch as well.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you're not really rooting for him, right? Whereas you are rooting for Tyrion, I think.
I think it's not too difficult to root for Tywin because I've got this idea that if Tywin was sitting on the Iron Throne, the people would have a pretty good time.
Okay.
Like I think there'd be more misery in the lords and ladies of Westeros, but I think the people, like, he's going to make sure they're fed and protected and the wagons run on time and shit, he might even get old Jor a couple more men. You know, I just feel like that he's such a great plotter and administrator that even if he is a lawful evil character, better lawful evil than what would Bobby B be? Chaotic good?
Or Joffrey.
Chaotic neutral or Joffrey who's chaotic evil, you know? So sometimes it's all right to root for lawful evil.
Yeah. One thing we know Tywin is not good at is fighting battles. Waging war, apparently, because he's getting his ass kicked by Rob.
Yeah, he is.
Just up and down Westeros. And it was interesting to see that they don't even show us the battle this episode, right? Like, a battle clearly happens, and we see the aftermath, and we see the start of it, but we don't see the battle itself.
Yeah, and it's such a huge contrast between things that happen later, and, you know, this is all budget, where, like, the Double D's at first can only afford a splash or two of amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, predictably, as you get further in the series, and, you know, I guess shoot me if you consider this a spoiler, the budget increases. Game of Thrones is watched by 100 million people worldwide. HBO has money shooting out of all their orifices, and they decide to blow a little bit on Game of Thrones seasons, and as a result is much more spectacle.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's funny because that's a lot of the experience in the books. that I don't think George likes writing battles. A lot of things in the books go down like he will lovingly tell the tale of Ned getting beheaded because that's a smaller, intimate, you know, the crowd shouting.
Right.
And like duels, like for example, Bronn versus, you know, Goofus Gallant from the Vale. I forget his actual name. He'll go in to describe that, but like a big old, you know, couple that, like, I feel like George himself is bored with them.
Okay, I can see that. It's not a particularly interesting thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, tell us why they're fighting. Tell us who wins, but I guess you don't have to describe in detail every sword swing.
Right. Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, there's two schools. I like, for example, it's the Dan Carlin approach to warfare versus like the Hank Green or John Green approach to warfare and Crash Course World History. John Green's like, I'm talking about the effects that these battles had on the sides that fought and the long-term political and historical ramifications, where Dan Carlin's like, yeah, let me tell you what it feels like to be at the Battle of the Somme. Mm-hmm. I'm going to spend an hour and 40 minutes making sure that you feel the full weight of the terror and the blood and the violence that these men went through.
Yeah.
Which one's right, which one's wrong?
Well, Game of Thrones feels to me more like the former.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Which, if that's what George is going for, then he seems to have nailed it.
Yeah. Thus far, anyway.
Yeah. Why don't we get into the recap?
Yeah, I want to start, before you get to recap, one thing I noted in the titles. What do you call that? The credit sequence.
Uh-huh.
When they get around to showing Harrenhal, it's the only location that is completely dead and inert. Like, no clockwork, anything pops out, no little flags unfurl. It just sits there like the ruined heap it is. And it's, I think that's nice interesting touch, how they set that apart. And it's also echoed when we finally see it. Like, it's as close to a haunted location as we've ever seen in Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
So there, that's it. Now you can get to recap.
Okay.
Before we get to the episode, I want to talk about some things that are happening this week on Bald Move. We got Blade Runner 2049 as a first-run movie. Mm-hmm. The spoiler-free review and mention of upcoming movies is free. If you want to hear the whole thing, you got to be a club member at club.baldmove.com. Speaking of that, we got Quit Your Pitching coming out tomorrow. Also, Jim and I, we've gotten a lot of email about this, a lot of forum interest. We are covering Stranger Things Season 2, and we are in process of recording all retrospective episodes of season one that we're going to drop like 2 weeks before the premiere hits. And then our plan is to, the week before, have like a season two preview. And then our goal is to cover the entirety of season two over that opening weekend and have all our podcast out as so some sort of marathon.
Yeah. They're instant take format.
Yeah.
With slight modification, but yeah, they'll basically be instant takes, not like the full 2 hour marathon
right.
Game of Thrones podcast. So
right, but I'm excited about that. Cecily and I are still holding down the fort over on American Horror Story Cult Land. Boy, Mr. Robot has snuck up on us.
Yeah.
It's coming out next Wednesday, not this Wednesday, next Wednesday. We'll of course have episode by episode coverage of that.
Those will be out on Fridays.
And then also want to mention, because people a lot of times email us and say, boy, we like your shows, but you're just clogging our subscription feeds with them. We have these things we call fire hose feeds, where you can get, you can download like essentially everything the Bald Move comes out with in a nice little list. It keeps it all together as a Bald Move feed. You can go to our website and click on podcast for those different feed options. So that's again, if you subscribe to multiple of our shows or you want to always get the latest and greatest, and there's an ad-free premium version of that for club members and then the regular version for everybody else. But check it out on baldmove.com. Oh shit, I almost forgot the biggest thing. New Star Trek.
Yeah.
New Star Trek, Jim, came out.
First one in like a decade.
And we've seen it, and we have thoughts. We're going to be doing a Bald Move TV later this week about the first three episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've been clamoring for that, and I know a lot of people have, stay tuned. It's going to be on the Bald Move TV feed.
We start off with the Lannister troops arguing about who the best knight is and who would win in a fight. That kind of stuff seems to happen all the time.
The fandom loves it.
Whether it's medieval
or
whether it's 2017, people are going to argue about who's the best at fighting.
People love debate, and it also, like in our current society, it's the greatest of all time debates, you know, Jordan, LeBron,
sure.
Or
yeah, which is essentially just who would win in a fight.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, or football, you know, is it John L, or is it, you know, fucking
Billy
Joe Montana,
Joel
or
Elton John
Elway, or Tom Brady, or yeah it's like people like to debate what's the best, because it's a harmless way to kind of I don't know, like, get away without arguing real things like politics or religion. Although I guess in medieval times it's kind of the same.
Sort of, yeah.
Like, if our guy can beat up their guy, then might makes right, am I right?
Is my king better than your king? Yeah.
yeah.
Pretty much.
My king can kick your king's ass, buddy. And I got 100,000 of my mates here to prove it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is interesting. It is my least favorite form of discussion to have in regards to Game of Thrones.
Absolutely.
Just premature, what do you call that? Prophylactically shutting down the email debates.
All right. This guy, I don't know, says he sees something in the woods and rips a giant fart, which turns out he shouldn't have been joking around because Rob's wolf attacks them and this off-screen battle begins. Afterward, Rob is victorious. Roose says, hey, we won the battle, but we can't keep all the survivors prisoners because we don't have food for them. And he plans to torture the officers. Rob says they're not going to torture anyone because essentially he doesn't want to give an excuse for the Lannisters to torture his sister.
The Lannister army didn't get that memo. I mean, they're not torturing a sister, but they're torturing plenty of people.
They are, yeah. And Joffrey is kind of torturing his sister anyway.
That's true.
Like,
I
don't know that taking the high road is the right way, like Roose says, you know?
Yeah, no, I think this episode is kind of... Well, I mean, not like if Rob tortures back, yeah. It's not like it stops it. So, I mean, I think the argument against torture is basically, A, it doesn't work.
And B, it's just
most
wrong.
Circumstances. Yeah. And B, there's a moral cost to you and your side for doing it.
Right.
And it has nothing to do with, like, well, we don't want the other people. I mean, that's certainly if you're debating or you're fighting a civilized society, maybe you could say that. But, you know, you're fucking...
I mean, if the winner is the person who takes the lowest road, long term, that's a terrible strategy for everyone involved.
Yeah.
Except for, I guess, the lord who's taking the lowest road.
Yeah. And when you're talking about, like, ultimately very long historical timelines, the side of evil almost never wins. Well, never wins, because everyone eventually dies, and their reign of terror ends.
Then the side of good never wins either,
well,
because everyone dies.
Yeah, you're right. The universe is dark and full of terrors and doesn't give a shit.
Yep.
But I'm talking about, you know, human scales, I think that matters, because, you know, happiness and justice and freedom are better than slavery and malice and pain. So
not according to Roose. Bruce
That's
is
true.
All about flaying people.
That's true. He's all in favor of flaying others, though. See?
Yeah.
It's like he doesn't, like, okay, Roose, what do you got? What do you got planned? What do you got? I don't trust you all of a sudden. Let's flay you first. So I can see the efficacy of it. No, I don't think he'd be in favor of that.
Rob spots this female field medic named Talisa. She says it a little differently.
Talisa
or something.
Sure.
And helps amputate this guy's foot. And then she gives Rob some shit about waging war and killing people and how this kid was a victim of that. Rob's sort of, I guess, intrigued by how she's standing up to him is how I would describe this.
And also she's a looker.
Well, of course, yeah. Although she's covered in goat's blood.
I just think that if she was like a fucking stereotypical woods witch, just
right.
Like, oh, Lord, what do you think? You know, it's like, this boy was the poor for meeting you. He had been like, shut up, winch. But,
right.
You know, looking
Roose,
like...
Roose, you want somebody to flay?
That's right. I think looking like Talisa is a good way to carry an argument with old Rob here. He's Twitter-pated.
Yeah.
Twitter-pated, I think, is what Bambi's mother would describe him as. Or is a Thumper's dad? I don't know.
Okay.
Sure, I throw Bambi references in my Game of Thrones coverage. Sue me.
I just can't handle this foot amputation. This
it is
the maybe the worst thing that anyone can ever do, is just take a bone saw to a leg.
It is pretty... It is pretty amazing to think about that as kind of battlefield amputations back in the day before you had it's such a cold-blooded thing to do for the person healing, like just like you're a butcher and they're a lamb and the person, like the horror that like, yeah, oh God, they're going to saw off my leg. Oh shit, it's happening and I'm feeling it.
Yeah.
Oh, they hit the bone. No, it's not a good time for anybody, but it saved your life.
Yeah, yeah. That's the thing. It's...
3 times out of 10.
Right. Right. I guess it's worth it.
Maybe it's like, you know, on balance, would you rather have an axe in the head and just have it over with, or, you know?
Right. Would you rather die 10 times out of 10?
And, you know, they also do something. I think they're trying to do something interesting but they didn't quite pull it off with this guy saying, no, no, I don't want to be a cripple.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, Rob reflecting on his brother and how, like, you know, Bran's going to be a cripple and he's going to be a lord. And this guy, if he's a cripple, mm-hmm. he might starve when winter comes. Like, yeah. But it didn't quite land.
Not quite. It was just sort of cut off at right. the knees, no pun intended.
Right.
They really just shit all over this scene with the subtitles too, because
yeah.
there's this moment. Did you see this where Rob like bends down and he holds this guy down and he says, "No, no, you'll die if she doesn't."
Yeah.
And the subtitles say, "You'll die if she does it."
Yeah.
Like, that's completely
well,
opposite
also,
sentiment.
Also, when they're sailing Stannis' fleet, the guy says, "Keep a table length apart," or he says a cable length. Because
yeah,
and then they said a table length on the subtitles.
I'm like, how long are these fucking tables that they've got on these boats?
It's weird, because like, last night I was watching Blade Runner to prep for our first run Bald movie this Thursday night.
Yeah.
And same thing, the subtitles weren't even trying. It's like, you know, this guy would say 30 words and they would sum up in like five
yeah.
or like give. It's yeah, it's like it's
that's
pretty
so weird
bad.
With something that is prepared so far in advance.
Yeah. 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 I get so. It. And also mm-hmm. like how many people have sent in with corrections
yeah.
and they just like, nah, we're good.
Yep.
I don't know how hard it is to update subtitles. Maybe it's some big bureaucratic nightmare.
It's a text file that a computer reads as
well,
far as I
yeah.
know.
I mean, technologically, but I'm talking about like. You know, it has
oh,
to go through lawyers and has to make, you know, like, I don't know. But someone's
maybe.
Asleep at the switch
yep.
with these subtitles. I noticed it too.
All right, we go over to Joffrey, who's pointing a crossbow at Sansa and deciding whether or not to kill her. He says, "Oh, I can't kill you because my mother wants you alive." But he has Ser Meron Trant beat and humiliate her until Tyrion arrives and puts an end to it.
Ser Meron Trant, you'll recall, is the guy who slaughtered a man with a wooden stick.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Arya's teacher.
I don't think anyone thinks much of his fighting ability. I don't think the Hound mm-hmm. thinks much of his bullshit. That's clearly Bronn does
yeah.
not the thinks he could kill him without breaking a sweat.
I think Bronn would kill him.
I think Bronn would kill him.
Yeah.
I think Tyrion might take him. Like I would like to see Ser Meron Trant against anyone in armor and with a good piece of steel.
Yeah. So Tyrion continues, he chastises, is that a word?
Yeah.
That's a word that I can say, right?
Yeah.
Joffrey, and then he removes Sansa from the situation, apologizing on Joffrey's behalf and asking if she wants to end her engagement, but she totally stays on message here, saying she loves Joffrey, which is ridiculous.
It's ridiculous, but from Sansa's perspective,
yeah.
this could be an elaborate trap.
Yep.
Because Cersei's done this shit to her before, where she calls her love and little dove and little bird and all this, and she's actually sliding the dagger between her ribs. So I think this is more about the strength of Sansa and her
yeah.
willing to play the long game rather than go for broke on like an easy solution.
Right. And that's why Tyrion says at the end, "You may survive us yet."
Right. Like, it's hard to hate Sansa when Tyrion's given her respect.
Uh-huh.
Especially in the season of peak Tyrion, like we're experiencing.
And this scene is more peak Tyrion. Like, he comes
oh,
in
yeah.
and he you can see on Joffrey's face he's been caught.
Right.
Which is awesome.
Yeah.
I'm surprised Tyrion doesn't get his slapping hands out here.
Yeah.
But he's...
It is in front of court. I think even he... Like, that's why Tyrion's the smart one.
I feel like that's why he should be slapped.
Yeah.
Because Joffrey's doing all this stuff in front of the lords and ladies. This is ridiculous.
Right. But yeah, the whole, like, difference between a threat and education
yeah.
was great.
Did you see the difference?
Yeah, if he opens his mouth, kill him, Bronn. See,
yeah.
that's a threat. It's great. And he's like, you know, Joffrey, in addition to being cruel, he's unfathomably stupid.
Yeah.
Like, we see this over and over again. Like, every petty decision he makes puts himself more in trouble. And, like, he doesn't understand that disrespecting his future wife is the same as disrespecting himself.
Yeah. It's incredibly stupid.
And pointless, because, you know, obviously Sansa is not part of Rob's war council. So, like, a beating or abusing... And as Tyrion probably would point out, like... What the fuck? They have one of our most important hostages. Mm-hmm. What the hell? That's the other, like, low-key thing that Joffrey is not giving a shit about, and he should.
Yeah. And you see that in contrast to Rob in the previous scene, which just makes it all the more stupid.
And that's the thing, like I feel like this is a believable peak Tyrion because I feel like the bad guys would have done what the bad guys did, and Tyrion comes in and he's righteously angry and correct in everything he says. Like when Joffrey says the king can do as he likes, and he goes, "Oh, the Mad King did as he likes. Have you asked your Uncle Jaime what happened to him?" Like, yeah. It's not. Joffrey should know better than these things. If he paid attention to his own fucking family history, he would know better than this shit. But that's like, it really paints a picture of this cruel, ignorant, incurious boy that's sitting on the throne and the realm bleeding.
Yeah, and I get the impression that, you know, Cersei has not done much in the way of mothering this kid, right? Like, he's the oldest, so he's probably like the one who wins all the favor from the parents. That's typically how it goes.
Yeah.
Like the oldest kid, the first kid out is always like treated a little bit differently than the rest of the kids. Like the other kids like, "Oh yeah, we've been there before. We've had a kid. You're nothing special."
Right.
Whereas Joffrey was probably coddled a lot by Cersei.
Yeah, and we've even seen that. Like, this shit he's saying a king can do as he likes is shit that his mother was saying to him after he got bit by Sansa's wolf last year.
Yeah.
Like, this is not accidentally bad parenting. This is, I don't know, it's hard to defend anything about Cersei and Joffrey and
I can't get over it, the false information that's being spread here. Like, Lancel's story about what the fuck is happening to all these lords and ladies and the Lannisters being eaten by Robb's men after the battle, and like, he's just going on just some lunacy.
It's not Rob, because if they admit that Rob, this untested boy, is whipping their ass, it's got to be witchcraft with an army of magical wolves. And, you know, like, Rob's got to be it reminds me a lot when like, one's political enemy is described as being stupid. It's like, well, if you're being beat by a fucking moron, then what does that say about what you're doing? Like, it's like, it's at best unhelpful, and at worst, it's an admission of you not being able to compete in the marketplace of ideas.
That's what Rob says to Jaime, effectively. You know,
yeah,
when he's
exactly.
Got him in the cage.
Exactly. That you insult
beat
your
opposition.
You can't insult your opposition without also demeaning any victory you win.
Unless. Yeah, well,
and making any defeat a humiliation.
Right,
so.
Right. So Joffrey goes back to his chambers where the Hound is waiting with a name day gift of two prostitutes, one of them being Roz, who we're familiar with. He decides to send a message.
The other one was Jizmouth, I do believe. I don't know her name.
Jizmouth.
I think that's her name.
I heard Littlefinger say something about that, yeah.
Jizmouth. She's from the island of Spooge.
Okay. I did not recognize her. Anyway, he decides to send a message to Tyrion by having one of them beat the other pretty severely. It starts off, you know, can you hit her? And then gets the belt out, and then he gets this staff with, I don't know, antlers on it or something.
Yeah, it's a scepter, I suppose.
Has her go to town under threat of the same thing happening to her.
And he's winding his crossbow to kind of make a point of it. I mean,
yeah.
I guess I thought the implication is Roz is going to beat this woman to death.
Okay, maybe.
Which, like, I don't like, you know,
I don't know why Joffrey would stop in private if he wouldn't in public.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, I think that this is when Bronn's saying the little king's backed up, but he's got a different kind of boner that you can't beat that way. And also, there's no cure for being a cunt. That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. The best you can hope for is spontaneous remission. Like, someone just wakes up and like, shit, I've been a cunt my whole life. I need to make amends and change my ways.
Yeah, good luck.
Sometimes
with this guy.
That happens, but there is no like cure to be administered at this point.
Yeah,
and it's what is Joff's damage? Like, do you think? And I don't know if this is even interesting to debate, but like, did he want to send this message to his uncle by disrespecting, like, by, you know, like, this is literal objectification of these women. Like, I'm going to use them as to send a message that, like, you can't do a nice thing. I'm not going to accept your gifts, blah, blah, blah. And he decided, like, ooh, this is fun, or... Like, I'm trying to say, is he more indulging his dark impulses here, or is he more sending a message to Tyrion, or is a little bit of both?
I think there's a little bit of both, but I would say he is more leaning just toward his dark impulses. I think he's not clever enough to realize what kind of message he's sending necessarily. He just knows that Tyrion won't like it.
Yeah, to put it mildly.
I just don't give Joffrey much credit at any point during the series.
Yeah. And the fact that he sees this as a like, I guess if he's sending a message, he would see this as a like kind of, like, Tyrion kind of humiliating me at court is to get back at that, I'm going to have this one woman murder this other woman.
Yeah.
That's pretty, you know, pretty fucked up.
And I guess this is actually a gift from Tyrion for his name day. Like, is he trying to do something he thinks is cool for his nephew?
I mean, that's what his conversation with Bronn, where Bronn suggests that maybe he's just horny. Like, he needs to get some of this shit out of his system. And Tyrion's like, well, fuck,
try
anything.
He thinks this might be a solution.
Yeah, and I'm curious because I honestly don't know how Tyrion reacts to this, but...
It says more about Bronn, I think, than it does Joffrey.
yeah, but I wonder, like, how... Because I wonder if Tyrion actually thought Joffrey was capable of something like this. It doesn't seem like he would because, you know, Tyrion had affection for Roz way back since the beginning of season one, when we literally first meet him. So I don't think he would send her in a situation where he thought that she would be tortured.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think he'd send anyone, you know, especially someone he actually has some kind of, you know, connection to. So
yeah, he underestimated him. So let's go over to Littlefinger arriving in Renly's camp. He tells Renly, it's not a threat. It's more like an offer to help him. That when he arrives in King's Landing, he may find either a protracted siege or open gates.
Yeah.
Depending on how he reacts here. I think Renly is smart to not like Littlefinger. I do agree with Littlefinger's point that, you know, once Robert is dead, what's the point of staying loyal to his corpse? Like that is, I don't view that necessarily as opportunism. It's more like he said, practical, you know?
Right.
But at the same time, Renly's not wrong either. Everything that comes out of Littlefinger's mouth, you have to just kind of take with a grain of salt.
Well, that's exactly why, like, if I was Renly, I'd be like, okay, in the set of possibilities, me coming up to King's Landing, the gates opening because I buttered Littlefinger's toast could happen. But I'd be a fool to plan for that eventuality.
Yeah.
It's more like a pleasant surprise.
I hope for the best, plan for the worst.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing about guys like Littlefinger is, in that circumstance, like, okay, you open the gates and I guess you get your reward, but it's nothing you can count on.
No.
And also he's like, even in this thing, he is kind of playing both sides a little bit, which is kind of, that's his character. That's his character. It must be stressful. And like being Peter, like he's probably got a resting heart rate of like 140, you know, because he just like his stress response must be like he's like every moment could be his last because there's going to be a dagger or a cross just because he fucks over so many people and lies. Yeah. How do you keep it straight? Like this later when he confronts Kat and she's hitting him with the fucking truth.
Yeah.
Like, you're a shit. You said, I thought you were a shit. You said you weren't a shit. I trusted you and you were a shit.
Yep. She's got a dead to rights.
And now, you know what? I'm starting to trust you again because it's the only way you're a shit, Littlefinger. Yeah. He's a shit.
He's going around, I guess, to everybody in this camp trying to find things out and win some favor, but he's not finding much success in Renly or Margaery because when he starts talking to her about her and Renly's marriage and their sex life, she totally shuts him down, doesn't give away anything, and basically tells him plainly, I'm loyal to Renly, so go fuck yourself.
Mm-hmm.
He's not having much luck there. Yeah, Margaery is... Margaery plays this a lot smoother than Sansa. I get the feeling that Margaery has been around and done this before, you know?
Yeah, like she has been like trained to be a politically ambitious schemer in a way that Sansa has not. Sansa's been trained to be a lady from like a song or a story.
Right.
And Margaery's got a lot more to her. And the way she just smoothly shuts the door on Littlefinger with the, like, here's your tent, Lord Baelish. Like, it's really good.
He should have said, that's not my tent. You've mistaken it again. So we go over to Dany, and another writer has returned. This one speaks of the City of Carth, who said they would be honored to receive the Mother of Dragons. And Jorah ominously calls the gates of Carth the Garden of Bones.
Every time they shut the door on a traveler, Khaleesi, the garden grows. All right. All right, Sir Black Cloud. Sir Eeyore.
Do they do this constantly? Do they lure people in with promises of sanctuary and then let them die outside the gates?
I think it's more of like, I think what you're supposed to understand is this is Dani going all in.
Sure,
like,
she has
to. Like, if we go 3 days east, we don't have enough food or water to survive another trip, mm-hmm. what, west to get back where we're at? So,
yeah.
Like, Karth is like, it's kind of like the only gas station in the middle of the, you know, Death Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're not going to make it out of here if they don't if your credit card's declined. So, but yeah, it's a little corny, just a little corny.
Oh, okay, yeah. I mean, I didn't think it was very corny. I just thought this seems to be a pattern with him. If Jorah is familiar with it,
I guess so. That's true.
So
it's just like Jorah so far this season has been like a total like, you know, we're going to die, Khaleesi. You know, we're totally fucked,
yeah,
Khaleesi.
I guess he has. We have no water, Khaleesi.
Right. All the cows want you dead, Khaleesi.
The horses, the flies on the horses are dying, Khaleesi.
We have no wood to burn this man's head. You're making, your ass is writing checks that you can't cash, Khaleesi.
Yeah, she promises to come back and burn this city,
right.
His eyes probably bug out of his head.
Yeah, right. Oh, well, I mean, that's the, oh God, well, let's get to that scene before I...
Okay.
About it.
Let's move on to Arya and company arriving at Harrenhal. They're kept near the area where they torture people so that they can hear the screams. Someone is tortured and killed at random every day, they find out. And Arya begins repeating the names of Joffrey, Cersei, Illyn Payne, and the Hound as she lays in the mud.
Gendry ponders, what kind of fire melts stone? And Arya says, dragon fire. And I say, spoiler alert! What the fuck, you monster? We don't know that yet. It hasn't been established in canon.
No.
But I liked the visualization of Harrenhal. You know, mm-hmm. if you don't know the history of Harrenhal, it was this great fortress that the ruler of the Iron Islands before the Greyjoys built for himself. This big, especially magnificent castle that was going to be totally impregnable. And Aegon the Conqueror rode up and said, surrender. And Harren the Black said, no. And then Aegon said, fine. And he used his dragons to literally melt the castle around the guy. And ever since, it's been considered haunted. It's like paradoxically one of the wealthiest. Like, it has dominion over the Riverlands, one of the wealthiest holdings in Westeros. But also it has a history of people living there, meeting untimely ends.
And I guess it doesn't seem like anybody's living there right now.
Well, I mean, that was promised to Janos, right? And now it's been promised to Littlefinger, and mm-hmm. even Littlefinger, I think, said, "Yeah, but that's kind of cursed." Thanks.
Also, it's kind of melted. Like, I want a shiny new castle.
Yeah, I would build a small, comfortable keep for myself. I'd be like, "Yeah, I'll take the lands. I'll build my own. You know, I'll squirrel away enough money to build a humble little keep that I'll keep
right.
building up with my newfound wealth." Yeah, why would you? If it's a fucking ruin, and it can't be unruined.
Yeah.
Like, the fucking shit's literally been melted together.
I guess you could chop the top of it off. I don't know. It looks cool, though.
It seems to be cool. Like,
very, very...
It looks like a Universal Monster lot, like studio lot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, it's got, like shit hanging from the trees and blood, and, like, there's thunder and lightning, and there's a vampire counting numbers somewhere in the distance and laughing.
You know, I thought it was made out of very dark stone, but... Now that I realize, oh, it's burned, perhaps it's just charred.
I think it might be also black stone because he is Harren the Black. So I think that was like it's some kind of. So I actually paused the podcast to look into it, and I could. It doesn't seem like that's a fact that it was built out of dark stones. So I think you're supposed to understand it's just been scorched by dragonfire, scorched and melted.
Huh. I suppose it could be both. Dark stone just probably gets darker when it's scorched.
I think that's science.
That's how it goes.
The stone seed is strong.
Yeah. So Littlefinger goes to Catelyn, who accuses him of betraying Ned, which he definitely did. He loses his mind in this scene and tries to put a move on her until she spins around and threatens him with a knife. And then he offers to help return her girls to her if she releases Jaime. Before leaving her tent, he gives Catelyn a gift from Tyrion, which is Ned's bones.
Them bones.
What is Littlefinger thinking in this scene when he starts professing his love for the woman whose husband he just had a hand in killing?
So, like, the plain reading is that he's using that as a defense of like, why would I do this? Because you know I love you and blah, blah, blah. Which to me, it's like, that's a perfectly great, like, you go for this, like, oh, fate is under. Like, it's a transparently naked attempt.
Right.
The cynical in me says that this is a 1-2 punch designed to completely throw, like offer something. It's a negotiation tactic. Your first demand is ridiculous and ludicrous. So that's your second demand, no matter what, is going to come off as reasonable. And it seems to work.
Yeah.
So I feel like the cynical is the way to go. Like, yeah, I mean, obviously, if Kat will lost her mind and be like, you're right, Lord Baelish, this world doesn't make sense for me anymore. Welcome me into your tiny, scrawny arms.
Yeah.
He would be like, awesome. This yeah,
this went way better than I
this
expected.
This is way better than I expected. But I feel like the like 1-2 punch rope-a-dope thing is what he was really going for.
Yeah.
And that was spectacularly effective.
And he seems to even be offering things he doesn't have, like Arya.
Right.
I think he might know. It's possible he knows the whereabouts of Arya roughly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That maybe she was on the way to the wall. Maybe he thinks he can just go up there and get her and bring her back.
Or he might just be like, "We'll just fuck him over."
Sure.
Like
yeah.
We'll show up. Like if she has, you know, agreed to this grossly imbalanced trade.
Mm-hmm.
You, when we go show up at the scene and she's so close to getting her daughter back,
yeah,
and we say, well, Arya's escaped, is she going to call off the deal with her daughter in sight? And we slap a hood over her and drag, it's like, nah, probably not.
Probably not.
It's the same way that, you know, what's the guy, Jerry Lundgaard uses in Fargo when he's got the guy and he's sold him the rust protection package and the guy knows it's a crock of shit, he writes a check anyway because he wants the car.
Uh-huh.
It's basically the same thing.
Sure.
I've altered the deal, pray I don't alter any further.
Yep. Anything else?
I really like the subtle world building of having the Silent Sisters in the background doing their thing. They're the weird ninja looking nuns that have the funny headdress, and they were on the battlefield helping Talisa, and they were the women burying Ned's bones. Like they're this order. They're not Septas or Septons, but they are these people that take a vow of silence to serve and chastity to serve the stranger. And they're essentially the morticians of Westeros. They are in charge of like turning a body to skeletons using a combination of beetles and boiling. And they also will like stuff and partially mummify a body for presentation for like a state funeral or something.
Okay.
And they're both respected and feared.
Put the stones on the eyes.
I think
of
so.
John Arryn.
I think so. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Uh huh.
Okay. It's creepy, if you ask me.
Oh, that's what Westeros thinks too.
Okay, good.
I'm glad you're there. Give him a stag for the trouble, and don't look him in the eye because the stranger might get you next.
All right. The Lannisters wake Arya and the other prisoners, and the Mountain comes over to select the day's victim.
This is not my mountain, Jim.
No, fuck
this
no.
This is the beanpole that rides. This is no mountain.
Spoiler alert, this guy gets replaced. This actor
he was
gets replaced later on.
They had a badass mountain in season one.
Did they? I don't remember him.
He was a motherfucker, and he looked the part. And then they get, like, they had some kind of bullshit dispute over money or availability. Huh. I've heard many different stories about how this happened. And he didn't come back for season two. So they got this guy, who is just a really tall, skinny dude.
Yeah, they made his armor too big for him, too.
And that's the thing.
He
like,
just looks like dopey in that
like
that
I
suit
feel
of
like
armor.
They meant to make the armor ridiculously oversized and then like stuff it with a muscle suit or something.
Yeah.
They just forgot the muscle suit. They showed up, and it's just like, this shit's hanging on
saggy
him.
Saggy chainmail.
He looks like a goddamn scarecrow wearing chainmail, and he's the mountain. Because
yeah,
he's tall,
he was not intimidating.
No. The armor looks like you could just give him a stiff breeze and knock him over, and then he'd be helpless like a turtle trying to get up.
Yep.
It's sad. Like, how hard is it to go to a strongman competition, pick the biggest motherfucker in the lineup, and say, can you say, you? You can? You're hired. I don't. It's weirdly lazy casting.
Maybe they did that, and none of them could say you.
Yeah, the Nordic countries they all seem to come from. They just can't do yeah, yeah.
That's
it just won't come
yowl.
Out. Yeah, yowl. No, it's you. Yowl. You know, I don't know.
Fuck it. Let's get this tall, skinny guy.
Somehow we're probably being racist to Finnish people. I don't.
Because they speak a different language.
Yeah, and they can't say you
without the word you.
I'm sure they'll be like, not all Norsemen.
Probably. So she, Hot Pie decides he's going to stare down the mountain because this other guy says that's how he survived so long. And the guy who previously stared down the mountain gets picked that day, which makes Hot Pie piss himself.
This show, how did they get a laugh out of this grim moment?
I don't know. It's great. It's,
and I feel like the pissing of the Hot Pie was gratuitous in the same way the fart. Like, I don't know. Like the opening fart, maybe it's not bad, but like Hot Pie pissing himself? I don't know about that.
I don't know. He was clearly very scared. How
have you ever known
scared?
A person piss himself in fear?
No.
I haven't either.
But I've never been in a situation where that kind of fear would
but
kick
you know,
in.
I feel like that's like the equivalent of anime nosebleeds when you get a crush on a girl. Mm-hmm. Or like the weird flop sweat and the like hashtag that appears on their forehead when they're constantly... Like, that's
the hard
like
eyes
no one in the history of anything has pissed themselves in fear, but that's like...
I bet there are people who...
That's how
you know,
show people that are in extreme fear.
Have been to war or been victims of some kind of attack or something who would probably disagree. But I've been privileged never to be in a situation like that.
The thing is, like, I don't even think I've read a historical account of someone pissing himself. I literally think that's what dogs do. So then like a craven is showing this dog-like submissive behavior.
Maybe he's incontinent.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about that? Could Hot be. Pie? I mean, he's not physically well.
His prostate is the size of a watermelon. He's gotten some kind of weird Westerosi prostate cancer at the age of 14, and it's
they're living hard lives in Westeros.
Too many hot pies that can do damage.
So that guy gets pulled aside and he gets tortured to death with a rat who eats through his chest.
Yeah, that's a hard way to go. That's a long, slow, terrible death.
Yeah, got to be painful. And that night, Arya lays in the mud repeating the names, and she has added one, which is Polliver, the guy who's torturing them, and the guy who has her sword and killed her friend and all that. If you couldn't tell, this is the same guy who put the needle through that kid's neck, who he thought was Gendry. She has a pretty good reason to put him on the list.
Mm-hmm. They ask this question, like, you know, is there any gold and silver in the village? Is there any gems? Where's the Brotherhood without banners?
Yeah.
Who's helping them? Is this the first we've heard of the Brotherhood?
Maybe.
I'll say no more.
Bad memory for it. But yeah, who the hell are the Brotherhood?
Who the hell is this Brotherhood without banners? They sound cool.
Yeah, they're clearly
If they're against the beanpole, I'm for them.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. I guess I hadn't considered what exactly is going on here and who's in charge and for what reasons they're doing the things they are, but maybe we can talk about that when Tywin arrives.
Yes.
So we go to Stannis meeting with Renly, and Renly's needling him about taking a new sigil, and they're arguing back and forth about who's got the better claim and who's going to win. Stannis tells Renly that he has one night to pledge himself to his cause or he'll destroy him, and then before leaving, Melisandre tells Renly... The night is dark and full of terrors.
Ooh.
She loves to say that.
I thought this was a really great scene of Renly kind of rhetorically handing his brother his ass. And I don't know. Stannis doesn't like... I'm left to wonder if Stannis really wants his brother to back down. Because you remember like how little warmth he has for Roberts when like the guy's trying to put the harmless courtesy of my beloved brother. He's like, I didn't love him. He didn't love me. Like, it just paints this picture of like maybe Stannis would rather Renly fight him so that he can destroy him and not have him on the King's Council. Because like, you know, Renly doesn't respect him, and I don't think he ever will.
I don't know that Stannis wants a council. Like,
there's...
I just don't think Stannis likes anybody.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be in a small council. But
he wouldn't want you there. He doesn't want anybody there.
Melisandre starting up. He was born in salt and smoke, which is one of the famous parts of the Azor Ahai prophecy. He's like, oh, is he a ham?
Yeah, that's pretty
and
good.
Then when Stannis, like, anyone who denies that my claim to the throne is my foe, and he goes, they deny it from the wall to Dorne, from old men's dying death rattle to unborn babes in their mother's womb. It's just... It's so funny.
Yeah, Renly really defeats him on the battlefield of language here.
Yeah, and Stannis is so prickly. He sees Kat and just assumed, oh, your fucking son's in on him too. And even if he's not, he still won't bend the knee. So he's a foe too.
And also,
poor Stannis.
I couldn't help but think Stannis isn't really into all this religious stuff. Like he He kind of thinks he's using it as a means to an end, I think.
Yeah, plus he did really want to bone Melisandre.
Right, right. But I mean, for not believing wholeheartedly in this religious stuff, taking it as your fucking sigil.
Right.
Abandoning your family's sigil in favor of some religious symbol you don't really believe in is really weird.
But, I mean, it's the one...
Seems like a mistake.
It's the one non-pragmatic thing I think he does. Yeah. Like, it's like, well... There has been enough proof that there is something to this. I'm going to go all in because I don't have the numbers. I don't have anything. I might as well play to the one advantage I have, which is fanaticism. And maybe Melisandre will pop out a shadow baby for me.
Maybe some magic. All right, so Dany arrives at Qarth, or Qarth, as she says, where she's greeted by a rotund man with a name that can't be pronounced. And the rest of the quote-unquote 13.
I believe him, because Zarazan duck sauce is already... Me. Like, if it's worse than that, you're right. I don't want to truck with it.
I have Xanos von duck sauce written down.
Duck sauce was the canonical joke. Uh-huh. Because the way this guy pronounces doxus, it sounds exactly like duck sauce.
Yeah.
It sounds like, can I get some steamed white rice with some chicken? Can I get some of that Zarazan duck sauce? Because it really sets off the chicken.
Yeah. So they want to see the dragons before they let her into the city. And she refuses, and instead she threatens to return when her dragons are grown and burn their city to the ground. None of them like that, but Xanos von Duck Sauce decides to step up and invoke something called Sumai, which is some kind of vouching system that gets them through the gates. I never understand vouching systems.
Yeah,
I don't.
Yeah, I guess it's
I don't
like
them. I don't understand them. It's the opposite of a veto.
Uh-huh.
Like, how far can you take a vouching system? Could I, like, how far could I take Sumai? Could I say, I don't know, there is a horde of Dothraki. There's 100,000 of them out there, and I want them inside.
Yeah.
I invoke Sumai, and boom, we've got 100,000 Dothraki in.
I think it's one of those things where it's not, I wonder if there's, like, if three other people invoke anti-Sumai, then, like, it's one of those things where the president can override, or the Congress can override a presidential veto if they have a two-thirds majority. Because you're right. Like, what if he's, like, bringing in a nuclear bomb that's at 60 seconds ticking down to one, and he's letting the best bomb diffuser and the bomb in the city in the gates? Like, well, if you're wrong, because it's like... You know, if like let's say we're debating something a bald move, and you say I invoke Sumai, and you slice her hand. To me, that's saying this decision, if it backfires, you're going to make it good. Like, it's not going to come out of my fucking paycheck. This shit.
Uh-huh.
So like, it works on something like Dany bringing in 40 unwashed Dothraki.
Mm-hmm. Like maybe because what if this causes some reaction that burns the city to the ground?
That's what I'm saying.
Then
like, how can you make that good? Like,
right, you can't make that good.
Right, no, it's dumb. And this is also completely invented for the series. And
oh boy,
I think it's super dumb because in the books, like, Qarth wants her in there because her dragons are a sensation. They're like fucking cool. And Dany's like, yeah, look at my dragons, they're awesome.
Get some tourism up.
Give
there.
Give me some gold and give me some silks and like maybe flatter me with promises of stuff. But like, I don't understand why they went this path because number one. It's yet another opportunity for Dany to impotently swear revenge, though, like, and the guy just cuts her off at the knees because
Just said, we'll die without your help.
And if you don't help me, I'm going to kill you all. It's like fucking Cobra Commander level shit.
Yeah, it's so stupid.
You know, it's not great. And I don't understand why they did it because it seems like just letting, like the idea that this decadent court that's bored in the desert that they would want a novelty, and there's still challenges that Dany can then her challenges to be taken seriously.
Sure.
Now she's under this weird guy's kind of sort of protection, and I don't know, we'll see how it goes, but I really didn't like the scene. Also, well, shit, we decided that's a spoiler, so I gotta stop having my fun.
Okay. And I also don't understand Duck Sauce's statement here that they're retreating in fear from a little girl. I don't think that's what's happening here, Duck Sauce. You're misreading the room.
Right.
Like, they're not retreating in fear. They're simply not allowing her access, and she's making impotent threats that they acknowledge are impotent threats.
And
like,
why
that's not
won't,
fear.
Why won't she show them the dragons?
Because they're tiny and she thinks they'll take them? I don't know.
But they're in the fucking cat containers.
And she looks over conspicuously at them.
Right.
Saying, hey guys, my dragons are over there.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you don't really, like, if they want to take your dragons, they'll just fucking do it. There's 40 of you and a billion of them behind this wall, and they got spears and shit, and, like, you're just going to lose.
Yeah.
So, like, you keep playing the card you got until it doesn't work. I don't know. Nothing about this scene doesn't make sense, and it's dumb. I don't like it.
Incredibly dumb. Okay, let's move on to Gendry. He's taken from the pen that he's in and put in a torture chair. He won't answer questions, so they get the rat out. Fortunately for him, Tywin arrives and doesn't like what he sees. He tells them to put the prisoners to work instead of killing them, and he realizes Arya is a girl and makes her his cupbearer.
Mm-hmm.
So Big Daddy Tywin shows up, puts an end to all the fun. And this is the point where I should have realized that I guess he has multiple, like, obviously he would have multiple, like, groups of troops out mm-hmm. there, right? Some defending places, some attacking in other places. But I guess I didn't realize that there was kind of this loose hold on them that he had. I thought he ruled sort of with an iron fist.
Oh, I think you've got it right. I think the Mountain and his troop are his Gestapo units that allow mm-hmm. him, like, they can do things like before Game of Thrones started, the Mountain rode into King's Landing after the Mad King was slain and killed the prince's family with his bare hands, like smashed a baby's head against the wall, raped and murdered Ilaria, and did all this foul shit. And then Tywin could ride in and be like, oh, well, you know, my boys got a little rowdy and like, it allows him to, like, all punish them or whatever. And the same thing, like, you know, Ned saw this happening where it's like, oh, they're, you know, Tywin's bannermen's out in the Riverlands raping and reaving. Well, I'm going to hold Tywin responsible for this. And that, you know, we saw how that went for him. So I feel mm-hmm. like the Tywin's not pissed that they're torturing people.
Yeah.
That's like he wanted to do it. And he's going to ride in a couple days later and play the noble lord after they've already extracted what intelligence they can or, you know, I don't think.
I think he's a little bit angry about getting defeated again by Rob. And they certainly couldn't have known that they, you know, needed people that badly,
right,
for this war effort, because Tywin just over and over again gets his ass handed to him. And these guys, I don't think, are privy to that information immediately.
Right.
That, oh, we just lost another big battle.
Right.
So I don't know. I guess it's interesting to see him ride in and put the kibosh on all this. And I don't know what's going to happen with Arya here. You know, I don't think he realizes who she is exactly, but that she's a girl instead of a boy.
Well, and this is a threat opportunity for Arya. Like, if Tywin figures out who she is, mm-hmm. she's in big fucking trouble. And also,
true.
It strengthens the Lannister hands because they have now both daughters where they don't.
They just don't know. Yeah,
on the other hand, if she can slip under his defenses
right.
and she can get a fucking kitchen knife as her steward, like she can deal a death blow to the Lannister side.
So, yeah, you can see her eyeing Needle the whole scene, right?
Yeah.
They keep going back and forth between Tywin and the Needle. Yeah, Tywin and Needle.
Now, here's the thing. Like, the double D's giveth and double D's taketh away, because in the books, Tywin never comes to Harrenhal and Arya's never his steward.
Huh.
And
okay.
That this is like one of the best predicaments in this season. So like I think they whiffed on the whole fucking Sumai bullshit, and the Dany and Korth, but they hit a home run, largely because of you know, the chemistry that we'll see Maisie Williams and
Charles Dance.
Charles Dance, thank you.
Maisie just keeps getting better and better too. I think as the series progresses, even right now, like in season 2, she's great. She was great in season 1, but she's, you know, her character evolves, obviously, as all characters do. But Maisie just keeps getting better.
No, it's amazing how well they take this young, unknown cast and they essentially strike gold at every position, because these kids turn out to, you know, be really, really good actors, and none of them fucking lose their minds or do a Lindsay Lohan. Or is that a spoiler? To say that none of these,
nobody loses their mind. No real actors were harmed.
Have a heroin problem in season 7, and like, you just, it's really distracting how black her eyes, the circles in her eyes are, and how skinny she's getting. Like, Yeah, no, none of that happens. It seems like it's like
she doesn't get busted for drunk driving and removed.
There's all this
the
really
show.
Cute shit. Like you can find like Maisie. There's like videos that they've like record on Periscope of like Maisie and Sophie cruising around in a car doing Sean Bean impersonations.
Yeah,
it's just like it's a ton of fun. Like sure. There's a long running gag on the Blu-rays that every time the kids would do an episode, they would like an a cappella version of the Game of Thrones theme song.
Nice,
lots of good stuff. A real feel good moment.
Yeah, I'm not nearly as enamored with Lancel, the actor playing Lancel. His performance in this next scene, I think, is overdone, we'll say.
Is it supposed to be, though? Why don't you introduce the scene and we'll talk about it.
Okay, so Lancel shows up in Tyrion's quarters, I guess, and he's delivering a warrant from Cersei to release Pycelle. Tyrion realizes that somewhere along the way he's sleeping with Cersei and takes the opportunity to blackmail him into spying on Cersei for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, yeah, I'll release Pycelle in the morning. I don't really care about him.
Right.
I don't like the... I love the performance from Peter Dinklage. I don't like the performance from Lancel here. I just think it's over the top.
I feel like this is essentially a Monty Python skit, and Lancel is some doofus extra, and, you know, Peter Dinklage is John Cleese.
Yeah.
Like, he's supposed to look hapless and like jumped up, and I mean this is
he
the same
is,
guy
but,
that was intimidated by
yeah.
Bobby B getting the breast stretcher, and now because he's fucking his cousin and she's blowing sunshine and anointed night oil up his ass, he thinks he's something now. He's got a sword and he's big
sure,
but
yeah.
He's not. He's still the same guy, and Tyrion just tears him down.
I think you can express all of those sentiments, all those ideas, without making the performance over the top. And I think Pycelle is a good example of that last episode.
Hmm.
Yes, it's a ridiculous thing that's happening. You know,
yeah.
It's all a sham. It's a farce.
Yeah.
But Pycelle doesn't seem to be in on the joke. Here, Lancel seems to be in on the joke almost.
Hmm.
And I don't think he should be.
Well, I mean, I can't fault you because I just...
This is my, the way I'm reading
in,
it.
In my hypothesis, he is in on the joke because it's a Monty Python skit.
But right.
I kind of like appreciated the fact that it is a farce. But and like the fact that like... Does Tyrion know he's fucking Cersei, or does he go on a fishing expedition and then?
Yeah.
I feel like he had to know to go down that line of questioning.
Yeah, I don't think you're wrong in that because this Hour of the Wolf stuff. I don't know. There's a moment where he kind of says the Hour of the Wolf and takes a look up at Lancel to see his reaction.
I had the same thing. Like that's where the situation was balancing on a knife edge. Like
yeah.
If Lancel plays it cool.
Mm-hmm.
He might get out there without, you know, Tyrion branding his ass as owned by Tyrion Lannister.
Yeah, if this were Margaery, she would have played that.
Yeah,
too.
She would have said, "Yeah, well, here's your tint, Lord Tyrion," and flounced out. Lancel doesn't have that gear.
No, definitely not.
And then just when it shifts to pure panic, where he's like, "You know what? I can tell how hard it is. Let me get King Joffrey in here. He'll love to hear this."
Mm-hmm.
And like. You know, Lancel's not that stupid, and he knows what would happen.
Yeah.
Oh, man, he'd die so bad.
Can I ask you which one of the hours is the Hour of the Wolf?
This hour?
Is it midnight?
I can't
think.
Like I have no idea what the wolf's... If the wolf's hour is literally, like, midnight, or, like, you know, like we call the witching hour, or if it's just,
right.
like, saying, oh, dark 30. I don't...
Okay.
Like this is booty call o'clock is what I think his point is. Like why would you be
right.
in the Queen's chambers at whatever the o'clock it happens to be?
He could probably hear Lancel howling down the hall.
Yeah. If you know that's the thing, like if you know that there's a, you know, if you're a book reader who's read The World of Ice and Fire more than I have and you know what the Hour of the Wolf is.
Yeah.
Let us know.
I'm going to say it's like between 1:15 and 2:15 in the morning. When I went to a werewolf sort of thing. Like when the moon is highest and it's a full moon.
Yeah.
That's the Hour of the Wolf.
Yeah, but it only happens 28 days when the moon's full?
I don't know. How often do they bang? Probably more often than that. So we're back on Stannis' boat, and he's talking with Davos about how he chopped off his fingers for smuggling, apparently. And then Stannis asks him...
But also knighted him for his heroism.
Right. He's both a hero and a scum, a smuggler.
Han Solo.
Sure.
With more fingers.
Well, he still has the fingers.
Oh, less viewers.
Fewer fingers.
Exactly.
Yeah, he's such a stickler for grammar.
He is. It's such a great way to show how fucking prickly Stannis is.
Yeah. So Stannis, right after talking about cutting off his fingers for smuggling, asks him to smuggle Melisandre ashore, I guess, for an assassination attempt. And Davos gets her there, though he isn't happy about it.
Shore High, the promised beach. The beach that was promised.
They start philosophizing a little bit about, you know, the stuff that they both believe as they make their way into the cave where Melisandre removes her clothes and births an inky black shadow baby.
Mm-hmm.
That, I don't know, grabs these bars and the episode ends.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I mean, if we were looking for a sign of Melisandre's power that isn't just a parlor trick or something.
Right.
This is it.
Yeah.
There's no potions involved.
That's right. There's no developing immunity to Iocane powder.
No.
With having an inky black shadow baby shooting out of your nether region.
Yeah.
And it makes you think, like, what are the limits of this power? Can mm-hmm. she manifest like a trebuchet, an M1 Abrams? Like,
yeah.
An iron giant type killer robot? Like, what? How many times? Like, and was this the sun that she promised to Stannis?
Right.
What is its purpose?
I get the feeling it is. I get the feeling she's telling everyone things that are true. From a certain point of view, she says, you want to see what's under this robe, Davos, and I wonder,
that's the thing, like, I wonder what Stannis thought was going to happen, because she promised him a son, which is one of the things that excited him, other than her rockin' body last episode.
Mm-hmm.
But then, when he's parlaying with Renly, and he goes, I'll let you have your position, I'll even name you my heir until I'm born a male son, maybe thinking at that point in the episode, he still thought that this was, like, straight up, like, Melisandre's just going to bear me a child. But by the end of the episode, I feel like there's a little bit of a haunted quality with Stannis's talking to Davos.
Yeah.
Which implies that he knew exactly what was going to happen.
Yeah, I definitely think he knows that Melisandre is going to try to kill Renly.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if he knows exactly how.
Yeah. And I love the juxtaposition of, you know, this pregnant woman, Earth Mother imagery that's giving birth to something that is, like, looks like it's evil and of death rather than innocent and of life. That was one of the better kind of, like, visual, like, when she whips off her robe and she's, like, visibly pregnant mm-hmm. and, like, giving these birth pains. And, like, and it also just, like, thought it was really cool how she is looking, like, at wonder at this thing, and, like, Davos is recoiling at horror.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things I liked about the scene, like Davos and Stannis talking about it, and, like, you know, Stannis being so prickly, and when Davos is saying the Red Woman, he's like, he has a name, you know, and then the very next sentence he says the cargo you're smuggling is the Red Woman,
right?
Like, you know, Stannis doth protest a bit too much about all this.
Yeah. It's interesting too, because during this scene, you know, when she's birthing the shadow baby, the light from the lantern is really glowing very strongly,
mm-hmm.
More so than natural. I mean, Davos has to, like, take shelter from it, essentially.
Right.
It's so bright. I'm trying to see, like, what is the Lord of Light's power here, you know? Mm-hmm. Where does it come from? What are the extents of it? And I think Davos is also questioning those things, right? Like, why are you running around in the shadows if it's the Lord of Light? You know?
She has, like, a pretty good answer that, like, because that's the thing, like, you know, we usually think of, like, terms of shadow creatures being evil, but as she points out, like, in the darkness, there are no shadows. Mm-hmm. That shadows are born from the light. They're servants of shadows. That's not a bad apology for what's going on. But in the end, when Davos is saying, like, where there might be a cleaner option, and Stannis says, well, in warfare, you can't always afford those, like, you can see in Davos's mind, it's like, yeah, but, like, this feels evil.
Sure. It's very much the conversation Rob had with Roose.
Yeah, and I had a conversation with people and someone in an email, I can't remember who, about, you know, talking about the different forms of magic and the ice versus fire, and it's like one of those things is, like, is the Emperor evil because he uses force lightning, you know?
Or is it what and he is chooses to do
is
with
Is Obi-Wan evil because he uses the force to affect the weak-minded? Like,
right.
That sounds... Is Luke evil because he force chokes a Gamorrean guard? Like, mm-hmm. it's not the tool so much as how you use it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I guess that's...
He's evil because he kills the Rancor. That's
true. He was just some dude's pet. Like, what a fucking monster. That's that guy's Labrador Retriever, man.
Yeah, don't tell me you couldn't have got out there without killing it.
Not cool. But yeah, it's the same kind of question that, like, Tyrion propounds, Varys propounds to Tyrion about who has the power. Like, is this evil or not? Davos might think yes, but we got to see what the ends are before we even attempt to justify the means.
I suppose so. That's the end of the episode.
All right, Jim, it's time to stump for the club. You and me are in a room with a sellsword, with a credit card, and we're both trying to get him to join club.
Is it Bronn?
It's immaterial. Could be Loras. Could be Sir Janos Slynt now or recently of the Gold Cloaks, now of the Black, the Brothers Black. But we're both telling him to sign up for the club. Who has the power in this situation?
I mean, it's where the credit card is, right?
You're right. It's who holds the credit card. It's actually Visa and MasterCard.
They have the power.
They have the power.
Amazon also has the power. You can sign up with Amazon.
Has the power. PayPal does not have the power. PayPal will denied us their power, so they're just right out. They're left outside the cold, the baying of the dire wolves. But if you want to hold your credit card on high and sign up for the club with it, and torture this metaphor further, you can go to club.baldmove.com. Sign up for it. You get 30 days free. So there's my first argument. I don't know what Jim's going to say to get you to sign up, but like
I'm going
to
say
30 days free.
You get to watch us record the podcast as fast as possible live.
You can do that. There's bonus features. You can only get in the club. Ad-free feeds. We know a lot of people don't like ads, and you can skip all the ads with the ad-free feeds. I mean, like, what's the worst that can happen? You sign up, you get your free 30-day trial, and you fucking forget, like, for 3.5 years, and suddenly you've given us so much more money than you intended to. That's the worst thing that can happen, and how bad is it? Because you've passively supported okay podcasting for that long a time. I mean, it doesn't make you a history's monster.
No,
that's
not that bad.
You may be financially foolish, but that's the worst, literally the worst that can happen. You're not going to lose your head over it. Go check it out, club.baldmove.com. Before you even plunk out your credit card, we got a whole bunch of sample features and a description of the whole package and all that stuff. But there you go. You have the power. It resides in the plastic that you're probably sitting on, or maybe it's in the purse that's hanging on the hook by your door. Or maybe it's in your car, or maybe it's in your bed. I don't know where you women stick. I honestly don't know. Where do women store their purses when they're not in use?
Floor?
Is it?
Bed?
The floor?
Dresser?
The floor
is
the
home
of the purse?
Closet?
I flop my wallet in this little dish.
Yeah, I got a bowl.
Nine times out of ten, it's that one time out of ten that gets me.
When it's stuck in the crack between the cushions on the couch,
when I'm super lazy and I've put it somewhere, or I've left it in the basement in the garage because I came in that way for some reason. club.baldmove.com.
Do we have some feedback to do?
Oh boy, Jim, do we ever. Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. First up, Levi C. On this last podcast, someone asked what lies beyond the known world, and I was thinking of referencing A World of Ice and Fire. In it, it talks about a Valyrian dragon rider who set out for 3 years to see where Southeros ended, but she said there was no end in sight even after all that time. Holy shit. Like, I'm starting to think Southeros is procedurally generated like Minecraft.
Yeah.
Because flying a dragon for 3 fucking years and not seeing the end of it?
That's... you can't even do that on Earth.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. I don't know at this point how fast dragons can fly.
I suppose not, yeah.
But damn. Like, even if they're like a stately 40, like a ultralight 45 miles an hour.
You could Forrest Gump it across the Earth in 3 years.
I don't know. But there's the thing, like... I remember there's a story where George, you know, he writes that the wall is like 700 feet tall or whatever in the books. And then when he shows up and he looks at the animatics of what they've come up with, he's like, holy fucking shit, that's a tall wall. And he's like, yeah, it's half as tall as what you said it was in the books. And George is like, yeah, I'm not really great at the scale of things. Like, I just write big, awesome things because it sounds cool in my mind. But I, you know,
yeah.
It's one of those things. They continue. There's also the Green Hell, a.k.a. outside of the map we see of Southeris, that holds, allegedly, basilisks, vampire bats, tattooed lizards, giant snakes, spotted spiders, King Kong-sized giant apes, a winged dragon-like creature known as Wyverns, and Shirley's. The interior of Southeros is rumored to be a domain of barbarian tribes, cannibals, lost cities, and mythical races, including lizard men and blind cave dwellers.
Ah, Grumpkins and snarks, if you ask me.
I feel like this is a little... Yeah, I would be tempted to say, here lies dragons, except for north of the wall, here lies zombies, actually fucking true.
Right.
So, yeah. But yeah, interesting bit of world building. Although, yeah, I guess that's canon, because George wrote a lot of it and blessed it, but...
Yeah.
Until you see it in the books, it seems it beggars my imagination that someone could fly on a dragon for 3 years and not come to the end of a continent.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you told me she was like four wheeling it, okay, fine. Maybe there's a particularly bad shit. There's a place in Central America that I don't think anyone's actually driven over land through. What is that? The something gap? The
I don't know.
Who cares? Anyway, yeah. Is there, I lost my point. I was going to go say something else. Yeah, I don't buy.
You don't buy it. Okay.
It seems another 700-foot wall to say that this continent essentially is endless.
Yeah.
Jeffrey S. When Baelish meets with Lady Stark and offers to exchange Arya and Sansa for Jaime, how is Baelish going to make good on his promise if Lady Stark and Robb go for it when he does not have Arya? Does he think that he will get her by the time the exchange or an end? Robb and Lady Stark will take only Sansa for Jaime. If that's the case, he's being a total dick to her. If his plan is to hook up with her, how is he going to explain that he does not have Arya?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like I'm maybe being a little patronizing here, but this man murdered her husband.
Mm-hmm.
That was what we consider in bird culture to be a dick move.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's already been a dick to Kat.
Yeah.
So I don't think because. What is Littlefinger's love?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Like, I think it's such a thing, but like, I think he doesn't see Kat as a woman with her own agency and desires. It's an object of his desire.
Sure.
Yet another objectification of a woman here. So I don't think he has a problem with being dick move if it's going to get her him in the end, and if, you know, he thinks that's it's good for him, so it must be good for her.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty fucked up. In respect to Lady Stark, why does she immediately play Robb would never go for this? My math says two is more than one. Regardless of gender preferences, is she posturing? Is Robb that sexist? The Lannister line with Jaime is important, but can't be considered fundamental at this point, given that we have the Boy King, etc.
I think it's because she doesn't think he's negotiating with her.
Mm-hmm.
She thinks he's there saying that he's going to bring this deal to Robb.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that seems like a natural reaction.
But I also, I think that, you know, most points I'm very open to the idea of something being sexist. I don't think this is, because it's not so much that there are two little girls versus Jaime. It's more Jaime's relative importance in his family, with the fact because it's not even so much that he's in line, because at this point he is part, no, like, that's the thing, like, I'm a little confused about, does Tywin think that he can get Jaime to set aside his vows as a King's Guardian and renege on all that, and like he's like, okay, yeah, you're gonna play at this, but then when the time comes to take Casterly Rock, you're gonna fucking do it, because I'll be damned if Tyrion does,
right?
You know, like, I've always wondered, maybe, like, if Tywin thinks he can swing that. I kind of think he does.
Maybe.
If he had Joffrey under his control and he was the ruling as Hand of the King behind the power, that he can make all that happen.
Yeah, maybe so.
But that's why Jaime's more important than Sansa or Arya. I think it's relative, like, I mean, like, they're both, what, at best bishops, and he's a rook, if not a queen, in terms of importance.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that it's not sexist, the whole society is sexist. So it's you know, Jaime has been set up since birth to be, you know, someone who can handle responsibilities and military command and things like that. Whereas, you know, Catelyn's saying two little girls, they haven't been prepared for anything that would aid them in battle.
Right.
And that's, I think, the difference is yes, it's sexist, but that's kind of just how it goes in that society.
That's a good point. Like, baseline, yes, if you go back and say that, like, the options open to Jaime were never options open to Arya and Sansa. In fact, that's a huge part of Cersei's character development, that she's the opposite of chuffed to realize that her and Jaime are twins and they're identical in every way, except for she never got to wield power the way that a man would assume to be wielding power in Westeros. And that's one of the reasons, that's a lot of the reasons that she's got the damage that she's got.
But. Right. And I think if you were to ask Catelyn, is that sexist? She would say yes, but it's also how it is at the moment.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm not condoning it. I'm simply saying that's how it is in this world.
Yeah. But yeah, I think Rob himself, now that's why I think Littlefinger is really shrewd here, because Rob loves his sisters, but not in the way that his mom does.
Yeah.
And also, Rob's got this pressure of command that even if he robbed the man, would trade for his sisters for Jaime Lannister. Mm-hmm. Rob the king just can't.
Yeah,
and his men wouldn't allow it. Like his men would instantly turn against him if he did that. So mm-hmm. That's the stakes. That's the stakes, and that's why Littlefinger's trying to circumvent it. Josh L. want to add a note onto the topic of discussion regarding Varys' riddle. The riddle says the sellsword is confronted by a rich man, a pious priest, and a king, each asking for the sellsword's devotion at a cost to kill the others. Who holds the power in the room? The answer is the sellsword. The riddle is a test about class. To someone like Tyrion, the son of a high lord, the small folk are more or less pawns for the lords of the land. They do as they're told, and for their devotion they are given justice, protection, and care from their lords. But you can hear the lords discuss the small folk, and it's almost always in a negative light. They're useless mouths in a war since they can't fight. They have little lives. They're effectively scenery for most of the high lords. To someone like Varys, who pulled himself up through the dregs of the world, these small folks are the people who, together, create the pedestals on which powerful men rule. Yes, power resides where you think it does, but it's not between the crown, the wealthy, or the faithful. It's between the ruling classes and the ruled. Someone like Tyrion, at this point in the story, can't see beyond the power structure of which he benefits. And I fully believe this riddle is Varys testing Tyrion on this point. Tyrion never considers that the man with the sword holds the power. The riddle fits with the idea that Westeros could be headed towards a more civilized form of representative government. Maybe not a democracy, but one in which the small folk has some say. What do you think about the analysis of this riddle, Jim?
I mean, I think the sellsword has to believe that the power lies somewhere, right? And that if he's... You know, if he picks the wrong option here, he might also be killed himself.
Yeah.
Like, if the king has the actual power and he chooses to back the rich man, he might get killed. So,
right.
I mean, but at the same time, like, the other two will be dead. So whoever he believes, I don't know. I mean, I guess the analogy is problematic because a sellsword inherently takes money.
Yeah.
And the rich man has more money, certainly, than the priest. The king is debatable, but...
Because that's the thing, like, in this thing, like, in the way that Varys told the story, and I like your interpretation, but here's the reasons I disagree with it. Number one, I don't subscribe to Tyrion believing that the small folk are nothing. Like, I feel like even at this stage in the story, Tyrion understands that you cannot fucking shit on the people and expect to have a long and healthy and peaceful rule. And also, maybe if there was 100 sellswords, that the idea that this is the people would track better. But with one, it's more like, you know, who killed Ned Stark? Was it Illyn Payne or was it Joffrey?
Mm-hmm.
Because at this, like, the sellsword is more like a metaphor for, like, some kind of gun or some kind of instrument of will that's being inflected. It doesn't really have because the riddle says that these three people are going to, you know, try to have this discussion and influence the sellsword of who's going to kill and who ends up winning. Well, does that mean the sellsword made that decision? I don't know. I mean, I guess, yes, in a way he did, but the sellsword has societal limitations and roles and biases that are put on him just like the other three. So, I don't know.
It's not a perfect analogy.
It isn't.
Which is why it makes it so tough to analyze it so closely.
Yeah.
I prefer to sort of sit back and go with Varys' overall message here, which, regardless of how perfect or imperfect his analogy is, he has a point that he's trying to make, and that is the power resides where people think it does.
It's more like, you know what it is? It's like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Or does if a tree falls in a forest, does it make a sound? It's a good way to talk about issues and see how someone feels about something in a very abstract way.
Yeah.
But that also
makes it... But if you get into the very nitty-gritty details, it falls apart.
When you start saying, like, okay, the sellsword is the people, well, which person? Is it the person who just, you know, is content with a mug of wine and a whore once in a while? Is it the person that's very pious and hopes to... You know, like, people want different things. That's the hell of a democracy.
Yep.
You know, sometimes democracy doesn't give the results that are correct. So, it's like I said, good point. I don't fully agree with it, but I liked it enough to read it. And in the end, that's the only thing that matters on a podcast.
I suppose so.
I think we should get to the spoiler section now.
Okay.
So this is the point in the podcast where we start talking about book shit and stuff that happens in future episodes. So if you are not caught up on Game of Thrones, either the series or the book series, you may want to skip this next part. And it will always be here when you catch up, ready for your enjoyment. But that's a good enough... You've had enough time to shut off the podcast. Let's get to the spoilers. Okay.
Real quick, I want to tell people, I'm not sure if they know this, but we're going to cover everything from season two through the end of season seven. So, because like there may be people listening to this who have seen seasons five and think, oh, I can go and I can listen to it now.
Oh, yeah.
So seasons two through seven, we haven't seen eight yet. But
this is spoilers all.
As much as we got.
If you're using the Reddit terminology.
Okay.
So someone said on the forums that we were spoiling season two with this whole dragon count thing.
They're not wrong.
They're not wrong. And it's one of those things where they're not wrong, but also it's, you know, I do believe that that was in the trailer for season two, her screaming, where are my dragons? So it's also an extremely ticky-tacky point, but I'm trying real hard to be blameless when it comes to spoiler stuff. So we're going to move this into the spoiler section. And I also want to say, we didn't get a where is my, but we got a screamed my dragons and her threats outside the gates of court. So, and it's not a great performance because it's not a great scene.
Are you going with a Schrodinger's dragon thing not sure if they're in the box
or
not?
So this has gone from me proving myself right and the listener wrong to now like analyzing the culture phenomenon because it's gotcha. Undeniable that this was a meme that everyone accepted about the show. In fact, I've had multiple people forward me this pretty funny YouTube thing of Emilia Clarke saying, where is my everything? Like, she's just like, you know, where is my coffee? Where is where is the bathroom? Where's the toilet paper? Like, it's pretty funny. So she's leaning into it. It didn't come from nowhere. Where did it come from?
Gotcha.
And I'm saying she had a pretty, like, I remember Daenerys being kind of shittily written and her scenario being, like, even more frustrating than it is, just as we talked about in the preseason, that you got a situation where Dany was this badass person to birth dragons and she's swearing blood and fire on her enemies. And now she's essentially a prop comedy in this fat man's tight 10 minutes set, you know, outside the gates of Karth. So I feel like this is where it kind of begins, her screaming and yelling about her dragons and being completely impotent about it. It's not, I'm not even going to put a half dragon where my dragons count. I'm just saying, I think it begins here.
Okay.
Episode four. Do you have anything that you wanted to talk about? I already talked about they're not being
in particular now.
The whole scene with the Samai bullshit doesn't exist. I also, do you think, because in the book, so like something that's in the books that's a fact is that like all of the Stark children have some sort of green seeing and warging dreams except for Sansa because her wolf was murdered almost in the beginning.
Yeah.
There's a lot of fans that thought that this line with Lancel raving at court about, you know, Rob, you know, being a warlock that's using a bunch of magic wolves is kind of hinting on the fact that Rob is doing better than you would expect because he's using Grey Wind as like the second sight scout. Hmm. That like not even intent, like Grey Wind in patrolling the woods and Rob sleeping, he's getting these insights and these gut feelings that he then exploits. And I believe that to be true in the books. Do you think this is something that's being suggested in the show?
Not very well.
Really?
If that's the case.
Yeah.
if that's what they're going for, I wasn't picking it up.
It's funny because I sat up a little bit when I saw the scene start because I thought, oh, this is going to be when we're going to get some kind of weird wolf style cam of these two guys farting and whatnot. And because that's how I remember it, but it's not actually how it went down. So if it is, if they are trying to nod towards that eventuality, I don't think they did a particularly good job. And anything else we want to talk about for future events?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here that you could talk about, like Joffrey and his attitude and his, you know, what kind of trouble gets him in. But we've said so much about it.
I don't want this to be
it.
Like, oh, we see how later Roz gets crossbowed to death. Like, it's like this isn't like obvious shit. This is more like stuff that jumps out or is particularly interesting to debate in hindsight, I guess.
I guess there's an interesting relationship developing between Roos and Rob. And they have obvious disagreements in how to conduct themselves. And I feel like Rob only wins the day here, this conversation here, because his sisters are captive. Mm-hmm. And if they weren't, Roos would argue more strenuously or maybe go behind his back and just start flaying people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, when he mentions, hey, they have my sisters, and if we start flaying people, they're going to do the same to them.
Do you think Roos is true blue for Starks right now?
That's what I mean. Like, I'm not certain about that. I don't know when the betrayal happens, honestly.
Because I feel like that's the thing about Roos is I don't think that he's necessarily an evil character. I think he's very pragmatic. And he's like the other side's Tywin. And as soon as he sees Rob shit the bed diplomatically, which then leads to some military reversals, he's like, well, I mean, because, you know, Rob being king of the North is kind of a promotion for all the lords.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they go from sub-vassal vassals to, like, lords paramount mount in their own rights and their little fiefdoms in the North. Like, that's kind of a promotion. But, so I think Roos is, like, he's trying to help this young king. He's given him the best advice that he knows.
Yeah.
But
I mean, they clearly have different attitudes on
things.
Oh,
sure.
I don't think Rob, even if his sisters aren't captive, wants to torture people.
No, but I don't know. Like, where do you stand on that? Like, if you're the quote-unquote good guys, do you want an advisor there with the shadowy advice because someone should say it? Or do you think that should just never even be an option?
No, I think someone should be thinking about it. Because if the other side is capable of it, you need to know that, and you need to understand how they think.
Yeah.
You know, Tyrion talks about this a lot in Season 7, but...
Yeah,
I think it's important. It's just something that you probably shouldn't consider actually doing.
Plus, like, that's the thing is, like, you know, like we talked about in the opening, like, torture largely not working and the cost, the moral cost for your own side employing it. But also, you know, like, are there times, like, in the largely mythical, like, 24 cents where there's a ticking time bomb and this guy knows the code and you could break a few fingers and maybe... Like, it's whether he's tough enough to hold out, and, like, you can verify. Like, there's some times where you can employ torture, but it's just, like, really edge case kind of stuff. And maybe you want someone on your advisory council that's willing to be like, hey, maybe torture. I honestly don't know. I've never been a president or a commander. I don't know if that's useful or if that's, you know. Because the other thing is, like, you can say, like, every intelligent being knows that torture is a thing. So, therefore, it's de facto always an option. So, like, unless you think Rob's just a fucking idiot, he knows he could torture people. And Yeah, so, like, I guess that's the other viewpoint.
He knows he could, but I do think, you know, the label of high road is not completely off base here.
Yeah.
I think Rob is that kind of guy.
Okay, let's get to our first feedback then. Jody says, okay, regarding Margaery, is she or isn't she a virgin? Loras mentions to Renly that she's, well, officially a virgin. Renly seems not to care because, obviously, he wouldn't. Then later, Sansa and Margaery are talking about sex. Sansa asks, how do you know all this? Did your mother teach you? And she gets an, oh, crap kind of look and says, oh, yes, my mother taught me. What's your opinion, Jim?
My opinion is, officially, she's a virgin. I mean, of course she's around banging people.
I think in the books I believe they make it explicit because one of the things that she gets caught up in is she asks a maester for some moon tea, which is an abortificant.
Yeah.
So, like, obviously she's having sex with somebody. But on the other hand, Lady Olenna, which they haven't introduced yet, like, I have no doubt that part of the things that she learned at Lady Olenna's feet is how to manipulate men.
Sure.
And, you know, maybe it's not like what the men don't know about how you got this experience isn't going to hurt them, my dear.
Uh-huh.
and you want to be able to be real good at that because it's a surefire way to, I don't know. That's how I think. Yeah. Like it's hard to interpret that conversation with Sansa any other way. Mm-hmm. Sansa's the good girl and Marjorie's the one that's been around the block a while. Mm-hmm. Jake from Cincinnati. Hoping you guys might explain why you think House Tyrell would back Renly's claim in the first place. We know about Loras and Renly's relationship and Marjorie later being betrothed to Renly, but why would Lady Olenna, who we learn is behind all of House Tyrell's plays and extremely calculated, back Renly? I can't remember if Olenna offers any explanation when we meet her in Season 3, but I also wonder what the book explains about this, especially knowing what we learn... what we begin to learn to know about Olenna in later seasons seems to be very short-sighted play in hindsight.
Interesting. I guess I don't know the exact reasons, but I don't see a reason not to, right? She's got to back somebody.
Yeah, think about
the Rob kings. Would probably be smarter, but as he said, he doesn't really want to be the king.
Right.
He marries... you know, Marjorie off to Rob, and suddenly she's married to someone who doesn't want to be king.
Right. And the fact is I don't think the Renly would make a terrible king. Like, yeah, maybe a bad, like, wartime. And that's the other thing is, like, when we say it seems short-sighted play in hindsight, the hindsight that Stannis conjured a magical fucking ninja warrior out of Melisandre's cooch and killed the thing. Like, Renly is what made everyone, like, everyone then supported... either Stannis or Joffrey, but like at this point, Renly has the largest army and he will probably win.
Right. And especially because Tywin is distracted at the moment with the Lannister armies fighting Robb.
Exactly. And he's very good at motivating people and he's very charming and he's very good at working the relationships of the Lord and ladies, which is arguably, you know, like as Renly himself said, no, I don't think those banners are going to win me the fight. I think the men holding them will. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that Lady Olenna made a calculated mistake unless you think the calculated mistake should have contained a set of magical events that no one thinks is possible.
Right.
That's like, you know, saying that, like, you know, the Allies were like, you know, Russia was wrong to back the Allies because who knew the Martians were going to land in 1944 and whip the United States and France and England's ass? Like,
yeah,
dumbass Joseph Stalin didn't see the Martians coming. Like, you know,
yeah, I mean,
nobody did.
I would have a conversation about the merits of backing Rob. I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that Marjorie could have been married off to Rob because I don't know that Lady Olenna knows that Rob, you know, doesn't want to be king.
Right.
Clearly he's waging war against the Lannisters. She would assume that he would want to be king.
Right.
I don't see any reason not to back the Starks, honestly.
Well, but plus this all happened instantly. Like like Renly, Stannis and Rob raising their banners happened all at the same time because this letter going out saying that, you know, Joffrey is a bastard and like this all happened simultaneously. So it's like, you know, you make the best call that you can at the time. And also the other question I have, and I'm not set my mind in either direction, but I wonder how much actual power Lady Olenna actually has. I have always interpreted her as, especially before the death of her son, having more of soft power, like
influence,
you know, because she said
power.
Several times in the books and I think in the show that she didn't agree with a lot of the shit that her son did, and like, you know, was very skeptical of his military leadership and all. So like, I think that he's afraid to disappoint her, and obviously Marjorie respects her a lot, and that's the power I think she has that people confuse as hard power. Like, she has got Marjorie's ear, and Marjorie has got a hold on Joffrey, and then later the sweet one.
No, it's very much Tywin situation, right?
Yeah.
She's the same as Tywin. Tywin doesn't have the actual power in this family. Joffrey does.
But Tywin does have absolute power within the Lannisters. He doesn't have power within.
Well,
like,
he's got influence.
In
he's got that soft power over Joffrey, right?
But who's got more power of the Lannister family? Joffrey's a Baratheon officially.
Well, okay, officially.
Uh huh.
I mean, I assume, or I lump them all together.
Okay.
Cersei and Joffrey and Tywin and all of them.
Yeah, I guess that's I think Lady Olenna's is a little softer because she is. You got the lady in front of her, and as we mentioned, this is a sexist patriarchal society. But I don't know. Maybe there's a line in the books where actually she is pulling the strings from the very beginning, but I never interpreted that as to be like she's always the one that's got the right take.
Yeah.
And she survives because she kind of steers her own affairs clear of a lot of the bullshit. But you know, the day-to-day decisions that Highgarden makes, and like she's got input in it, but I don't know if she's got the final say. Moving on with Megan H. Watching the fourth season of season two is once again reminding me how ridiculous the will Dany become the Mad Queen hand-wringing is. The aftermath of the opening battle is disgusting and brutal, and I would hardly say appreciably worse than the loot train carnage. The Tarleys were leaders of the opposing army who had recently, and in Dickens' own view, unethically overthrown their liege lords. On top of that, Tyrion's supposed angst about the use of fire was always absurd given the context of the Battle of the Blackwater, and various memories of thinking I'm not the one doing it regarding the Mad King's abuses are ridiculous, as the Mad King was roasting people alive for torture and sport. The instant execution by dragonfire isn't any less just or honorable than death by sword, which is what we all seem to believe is fine.
Yeah. But you're missing the point about Tyrion is not worried about the troops. Tyrion is not worried about the people being burned in armor with swords in their hands. He's worried about the people in the city, the innocent people being burned alive by dragonfire.
And, you know, again, is it wise to burn these respected military commanders when if you burnt the father, maybe the son would come along, or if you give them both a couple times? Like, it's easy to be battlefield bravado, but if you put them in a cell for a couple days or weeks, maybe they would see reason. Whereas death is,
yeah,
like,
that's just a bad
or you've got
strategy.
You can use them as hostages. You can do a lot of, like, I think it's more Mad Queen because she wasn't making especially tactical or strategic decisions in favor of rigidly adhering to what she thought in her own heart was right, which is how any person goes crazy, right?
Sure.
So,
yeah, I was speaking like in regard to flying over King's Landing and burning it to the ground.
Yeah.
That's killing a million innocent people, essentially.
Right. And, you know, whether the Mad Queen hand-wringing is absurd or not, like, I think the show itself is asking us to wring our hands a little bit. Like, that's
absolutely is. And
multiple
I think that's
named
absurd.
Characters are saying it, and whether it's absurd or not, like, the show wants us to have a little moral panic about it, or else why are they doing it?
Absolutely. I think the part where I do agree is that they're going way overboard with it. Like, they've been doing this shit since season two, and guess what? It's still happening in season seven.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm on board with you there.
Arden, is there a hierarchy in the White Walkers that developed late in the series, or do you think the more armored White Walkers we see later are simply a change in choices by the Double Ds on how to present them? I seem to remember the early White Walkers being much less armored and less sophisticated in tactics. It seems like maybe the late seasons might have had Craster's babies being led by a military leader, whereas the early seasons, the White Walkers that are being killed off might have been older White Walkers that were turned longer in the past. I'm not sure any of the White Walkers share any memories if they're turned while still being alive rather than be turned into white. On that note, if the Night's King has a subordinate killed and the whites under that subordinate topple over from the master being killed, does the Night King have the ability to just re-raise them and add them to his number? At some point, why wouldn't he just insist that he raise the dead or respell them unless that's just not possible?
Then what if you kill him? Then they're all gone.
Sure. I mean, I feel like that's what we're all saying. If you kill the Night King, the whole show is shut down anyway, so there's little risk at putting all of the whites under his command. I don't know. No one knows how any of this stuff works. It's a little honestly worrisome that we don't know. It'd be like, you know, there's 5 minutes left of Star Wars and we're not sure if there's a button that destroys the Death Star. Like, you know, that's an ass pull already, but the later they make it, it's big. The bigger the ass pull.
Do the White Walkers have wardrobes? Do they change clothes, or are they just frozen with the clothes they have on them when they died?
I've seen that's a good question.
Or when they were turned?
Because I've seen White Walkers on horses, garbed like what I would like essentially loincloths, and that's it. And I've seen them wearing these ornate black armor pieces. So, and the Double Ds, you know, like we go from the Badass Mountain to the Mountain That Rides to the Strongman Mountain. Like, there's no real consistency there. And as the budget gets bigger, they tend to go back and plus some things. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to tell what kind of hierarchy there is. Like, Are the loincloth dudes like the recent Craster sons that they haven't earned their piece place at the table? Is there an original number of White Walkers that are some kind of significant, and they're the badasses rolling around the black armor? We don't know.
Do they like mount up? Do they get their armor on for a battle? Because certainly, like at the
yeah, maybe
early
going,
they
loincloths. But then it's like
yeah,
you know
early
what?
Going, it wasn't a war that they were waging, right? They were just out doing kind of stuff.
Yeah. And you know, like the White Walkers wear armor not to stay warm or whatever, but presumably to deflect things like obsidian arrows. And
although I don't know why,
why
it seems to destroy them in one shot anyway.
That's what I'm saying. Like, but. Is it if it touches their armor to destroy them?
I don't know.
Like if they had a shield, like how absurd does it get? Like I feel like that if you wear armor, it should fucking protect you.
Yeah.
Like it's got to at least touch your skin before it bursts you into, you know, safety glass. But the fact is, we just don't know enough to say, Arden. Vince C, when you guys were talking about Lightbringer, something occurred to me. What if the legend of Lightbringer isn't a legend of one specific sword, but instead some sort of guide to making Valyrian steel? Valyrian steel does seem to do what a magic sword would do, i.e. explode White Walkers, and in the real world, a lot of seemingly supernatural stories have some elements of truth. Is there any merit to this idea? I mean, so the Lightbringer legend is this story about Azor Ahai, and he has this wife named Nissa, and he makes a sword, and he quenches it and shatters it. He makes another sword, even longer and better. He quenches it in the heart of a lion, it shatters, and then he realizes he knows what he's got to do, and he makes another sword, even bigger and badder and badass, and he puts it through his wife Nissa's heart, and then it lights a fire and becomes Lightbringer. I sure hope that's not the recipe for Valyrian steel, because that requires a singular sacrifice every single time you make a blade.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't seem like that is... Like, I don't know. I mean, the Valyrians were slave traders. Maybe they did quench. That's a secret. You got to quench Valyrian steel in, like, the heart of a man or a woman. Maybe the wife is beside the point. But to me and a lot of other, you know, Game of Thrones... lore seekers, this smacks more of a parable about sacrifice that needs to happen to win something of value more than a literal sword.
Sure.
But, you know, that's there's nothing wrong with disagreeing with that. There's little evidence either way.
Mm-hmm.
Travis C, does Alistair Thorne show up in King's Landing with a rotten hand that's decidedly not animated? I suppose we can say a full-blown white can make the trip and not a partial one, because that seems less satisfying. Are we to assume the mechanic is simply different in the book versus the show? My recollection is when Alistair Thorne, he gets the runaround in King's Landing, and by the time someone gets him an audience to a throne room, he's just got a skeletal hand that's no longer animated because it's simply rotted away. So
I don't remember that stuff at all.
I don't think it might not. I think it happens in a show, but it's very low key. But in the books, like it for sure, he's sent down there and they give him the runaround and they keep delaying and keep delaying. By the time he gets an audience, it's no longer moving. And that implies that these things can rot away to a point where they can no longer function. Whereas that obviously didn't happen to John's. They brought him fresh. Now, the thing that muddies those waters, we've seen skeletal White Walkers, or I'm sorry, skeletal whites in the show, but those aren't really a thing in the books. So it could be the Double D's playing fast and loose, or, you know, whatever. But I do think there's a little bit of distinction there. Two, on Jon being named Aegon, wasn't the original baby Aegon murdered before the birth of Jon Snow? A lot of people were thrown off by this, but I can think of plenty of reasons Lyanna would want to name him Aegon. Whether to simply fulfill the prophecy her husband believed in so strongly or to honor his deceased son. Were they alive at the same time? Nope. Aegon, if you follow the official story, got his brain smashed in during the sack of King's Landing that happened quite a bit before the Tower of Joy shit. And if you believe the unofficial storyline, he got spirited away to Essos and he's now chilling as the codename Young Griff.
Yeah.
Which
I think that first one is his point, though, right? Like, Jon was named Aegon as tribute or in some kind of, like, prophecy fulfillment.
I think that's the most plausible.
Yeah.
And also, it's also plausible that There is going to be conflict between Aegon, who I think is a false Targaryen or maybe a Blackfyre Targaryen, and Dany was warned about as this Mummer's dragon that in some of the prophecies that I think Quaithe gave her to warn her. Or maybe there was a prophecy. No, I think that was the Quaithe thing. And then they're going to do some kind of bullshit drama between her and Jon. And so Jon's Aegon to kind of like take that mantle. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Like I think the Aegon in the books is not going to be anything but a speed bump on the way to Dany's throne. And I hope, to the extent that they're rolling him into Jon, it's no more a speed bump in their relationship, because I just don't buy that Jon would be a dick about being the actual king to an extent that would piss off Dany.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think he'd be like, oh, well, I abdicate. You're my queen. I'm the prince consort. Good enough for me.
I'm going to really confuse all the people in season 8 when I come back and I refuse to call Jon Snow Jon. And I just call
people
him Aegon.
Already doing it, and it's driving me fucking crazy.
Yeah.
If you are on the internet casually referring to Jon Snow as Aegon, you're kind of a dick. You're kind of a dick, and everyone's talking about you behind your back. Stop doing it.
Yeah.
He's Jon. You can say Jon, quote unquote, Aegon Snow if you want.
Yeah. Or just leave it at Jon. Jon's good enough.
Yeah.
I think Jon sees himself as Jon. How about
Aegon,
that?
Aegon is the Toby. To Jon Snow the Kunta Kinte. That's a horrible, wow, inappropriate reference. Okay. Aegon's his slave name, okay? That's exactly what I'm trying to say. That's exactly, and it's in the exact situation that LeVar Burton found himself. It's
I don't know. He had a pretty rough under Catelyn. I'll say.
It's true. That's
yeah.
True.
She was not kind to him.
She was the slave owner whipping him and calling him boy.
Pretty much.
And that's illustration. That's Tay. I immediately regret making it.
Shame on you.
But on the other hand, I'm super angry at the people that...
yeah.
And that justifies me being a monster.
Nope.
It doesn't?
No.
Fuck. All right. Let's move on. Chris P. Hey, while we're watching the early episodes of season 2, it got me wondering just how and why Jack and Hagar came to be part of the group heading towards the Walled Thicke Black. Knowing what we know now, it seems odd to me that Jaqen, a faceless man, the most skilled assassin, a master of disguises in the Game of Thrones universe. Are you selling me faceless men shares, man? Come on. Let's not suck the ghost of Jaqen's dick too hard here. Would be so easily captured. At first, I was happy to ignore this, as it seemed a way of getting Arya and Jaqen together so they can begin their arc. But on second thought, it seems a bit that something like this would just be thrown together as a matter of contrivance. Okay. So he propounds a lot of questions, but just to make a long story short, because I think we talked about this enough that you've kind of got a handle on some of the theories about this. What do you think's going on here?
That he's like here to recruit Arya? I don't know.
Do you want to go to the strong version of this theory?
Not really. Like I could also buy that he is. So, yes, when you sell it as Master of the Universe, Jack and Hagar got caught by some schmucks in the Lannister army.
Or, like, by
that's
gold
a little
cloaks
hard to believe.
In the city for,
yeah.
For what? Murdering a peasant or somebody, a scuffle he got in Flea Bottom?
Then again, I mean, wrong place, wrong time, right? It can happen.
Yeah.
It can happen. I get that he's a master of unlocking things and sneaking and killing people, but he could still get caught. I do believe that. So maybe he's just there and takes note of Arya because of her demeanor. Or he could be there to recruit her specifically. But I don't know why that would be the case, really. We still haven't found out information that would say he went specifically looking for Arya because X.
I mean, the thing is the books and the show are silent for why Jack and Hagar is in the Black Cells.
Yeah.
We don't know. We don't know why he's with... Rorge and Biter. We don't know why he seemed to be cool serving as a Lannister army man. We don't know why. Like, but there is a couple of kind of cool theories. One of the strongest forms is that for whatever reason, the Faceless Men took an interest in Arya and wanted to recruit her because they saw something in her.
Right. And that probably goes back to
Syrio Forel.
Syrio, yeah.
Who claims to be a swordsman from Bravosi.
Right.
And... you know, we're supposed to believe that Meryn Trant killed this man
mm-hmm.
when he's clearly an excellent sword fighter. He defeated 3 armored knights with a fucking wooden sword, and those armored knight swords are sitting on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't cartwheel over and grab a sword and fucking stick that into Meryn Trant's belly? Really?
Uh-huh.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
Meryn Trant, world-famed inept swordsman that no one with any skill of a sword is afraid of at any time in the fucking series.
Yep.
Is this guy that can defeat the first sword of Braavos? Fuck that noise. This theory goes on to state that Sirio, foiled by his attempts to recruit changed his face, went down, got himself imprisoned in the Black Cell because he heard that Yoren was taking her up to Winterfell, and he wanted to be on that train leaving the city. And then happenstance, the rest is literally history. I mean, you watch the rest of the show. So that's like the strong form of that theory. The weak form is that, you know, he was in there doing some unrelated thing. He was supposed to kill somebody. That either went wrong or he got sidetracked because he did see something in Arya that intrigued him that might serve the Many-Faced God. And because the other thing is, like, Jackins does a lot of other weird shit in the books that we don't often talk about because the books have been paused for so many years. Like, he's at the Citadel when Sam arrives, disguised as an alchemist for whatever reason. One of the sand snakes is up there too, undercover. There's like, what the fuck is he doing there? What purpose does that if he is trying to recruit Arya, then what is he doing over in the Citadel? No one knows because, again, the books have, like, the show has done the show thing and the books have been silent on the subject for a long, long time. Hmm. So, but yeah, there's a lot of cool speculative theories about there. Tom from just outside London says, I was listening to your recap podcast of season 2, episode 1, and in the feedback section, you were discussing the idea of an ending where you pan out and see George R.R. Martin writing. I have yet another idea. What if the show comes to a close, we see whoever might be sitting on the Iron Throne as they've claimed the Seven Kingdoms, and just as you think the credits are about to roll, everyone freezes. Anthony Hopkins steps into frame and says, this is our latest narrative, a song of ice and fire in our new park, Westeros world.
Yep.
Sweet, a sick tie-in.
So season 8 of Game of Thrones is simply a preview for season 2 of Westworld?
Yeah.
Or I guess that, season 3 at that point?
That is a compelling storyline. I want to sign up for the Jon Snow narrative.
Yeah. That one takes more than a couple weeks, I imagine.
Yeah, it's a sprawling 7-year arc
that
takes $1 billion and ends up with you sitting on the Iron Throne with Daenerys Targaryen in your lap, I guess. Unless you're the lady, in which it's probably the reverse.
Okay.
That's the cool thing about it. It's a unisex plot.
Yeah.
You come there as a well-heeled woman to Westeroser world, then you're going to be Dany. If you come as a well-heeled gent, you get to be Jamie. Freudian slip. You get to be John.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's move on. Spending too much time on a joke. Edward R. from Kansas City. Do you have any thoughts on what it means for the final season of Game of Thrones to be directed by Sapochnik, Nutter, and Benioff and Weiss? The double Ds are interesting choice. I read it may be only for the finale, which I suppose makes sense since they've been there from the start to finish, but I'm really excited about Sapochnik and Nutter.
Yeah, I feel like we at least owe them that, right? If they want to step in and direct the finale of the series, let them do it.
Yeah. I imagine the spectacle factor will be at an all-time high. Yeah, that's to me when they're saying they're going to David Nutter and Miguel Sapochnik. They're saying to the fans, we are putting our some of our best.
Hold on to your butts.
We are going to swing for the fences. And also, yeah, I'm not super worried about the double Ds directing an episode. I mean, geez, like, do you really think that they've... First of all, I believe they've directed an episode before.
Maybe. I don't remember.
But also, like, you know, there's always the first time, and these people have been running the show for 7 years. So if they've they've been behind the camera, they've been reviewing dailies, they've been giving directing notes to actors and whatnot this whole time. So I feel like they would probably be superb at it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm right on. I think the spectacle factor will be at an all time high. Chad M., regarding Lightbringer, it doesn't have to shoot swords or light or anything like that, but perhaps it glows red and can cut through White Walker's weapons the same way the White Walker weapons cut through normal steel.
I mean, John's sword already does that, right?
Well, it cuts through White Walker's, but, like, I guess that gets to my armor point, that, like, it can just cut through their armor or swords.
Hmm.
But is that, like, I'm saying, like, is that, like, ooh, Lightbringer? And also, what does having one of those swords do?
What if they just make a shield out of a tree or something? Like, It doesn't have any magical powers against trees.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, it's hard to find something that would be cooler than what we've already seen, which is swords on fire and swords making White Walkers burst into snow and not be like OP.
Yeah, no, I'm still hoping they pull something that it is going to be something cool, but who knows?
I think it's all a metaphor.
Maybe.
Randy, when I found out Jon Snow was 998th Lord Commander, I was bummed out because, like most, I thought him being Lord Commander would have some great historical significance to go along with the actual significance. However, my new theory has me even more excited. Jon Snow, 998, Dolorous Ed, 999th, mm-hmm. and Jaime Lannister, 1000th.
Oh, Aegon Targaryen, 1000.
Aegon Targaryen. Yeah, he holds two non-consecutive Lord Commanderships under different names.
And he'd be the last one, too, because he's undead.
Yeah, he's trying to outdo Grover Cleveland. Mm-hmm.
Jaime, huh?
I guess, like, why... So, to me, the reason I read this theory is because there is this cool kind of the deal, like the 1000th Lord Commander should be some kind of significance. And a lot of people thought before Jon came back that Jon's going to be 998th, someone would be 999th as a temporary, he'd come back to life as the 1000th, and that would unlock some kind of prophetic significance, and Jon would go forth and kick ass. Mm-hmm. Doesn't seem like it happens on the show, so now... And also there's that scene where Sam's in the libraries and saying, like, I really can only account for, like, 600 Lord Commanders. There doesn't even seem like there's enough time to be 1,000 Lord Commanders. Uh-huh. This thing's kind of a mess. Like, I feel like the double D saying us to kind of chill on that theory.
Maybe so. But if you don't want to chill, the one thing that I think is interesting about this theory is that Jaime has in the past been the protector of the realm in a certain sense, right?
Yeah. Eschewing honor and glory.
Yeah.
In exactly killing, the way a Black Brother should.
The Mad King, yeah. So he might be a fitting Lord Commander, mm-hmm. Defending the realm.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, but it's hard to say it's like a theory, you know? It's just like it's more of an idea or like... I mean, I'll go one... To me, if Jaime's the 1000th Lord Commander, like, there's also a finality to that. Like, he might be the last Lord Commander, and they just end up abolishing the... Like, the wall...
The wall is useless
now. The wall is got a big, giant hole in it. It's fallen. The White Walkers presumably are going to be defeated once for all time. I don't know, or maybe he's the first of a new, it's no longer going to be called the Night's Watch. Maybe they'll call it the Dawnbringers or something. I don't fucking know. But
Jaime's Watch.
Yeah, the Lannister Watch. It's a promotional thing.
Yeah, this Night's Watch thing, it had too much baggage.
Yeah.
We really just want to cleanse the palate here.
Plus the Lannister gold that they get from painting the gold line on the wall.
Are you saying they build a wall of gold?
I don't think they got it anymore.
Look, guys, the ice wall didn't do shit. Let's try this in gold this
time.
That Maybe thing gilded is, ice.
How are you going to protect that? Because, like, everyone's going to be stealing a brick off that.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
Anyway. Be tough. Final email from Sheridan S. regarding Gurm's writing delay. I think what George has done is nothing less than update our mythology for the modern day. He stepped right into the shoes of Tolkien, who stepped into the shoes of the anonymous Scops who brought us Beowulf, who in turn had stepped right into the shoes of Homer, and so on in a manner of apostolic succession in the Catholic Church. Whether he finishes or not is immaterial. In some ways, to leave his tale unfinished and unresolved would be the most modern thing of all, since solutions to our complex current problems up to which he has elevated our mythological impulses are tough and uncertain and unknown and may, in fact, never get solved. Or we may get cut off in our pursuit of the solution by God knows what, any number of things. Kudos and gratitude to him either way, whether he releases book 6 or 7 or not. That's fine. I mean, but, you know, in another way, in a more real and concrete way, he has failed to set out what he did, because I don't think in a million years you could convince me that George Martin meant to leave this thing unfinished as a way to say, like, man, our problems are, like, unsolvable, man.
No.
Like, I just don't buy it. So,
and even if that were the case, if that's the point he's trying to make, write an ending to your novel series that says that.
Yeah.
Don't leave the books unfinished so that no one knows the point.
I mean, I think you can leave something unfinished deliberately as a point. Like, you can have, like, you know, the
you can, certainly.
Like, I've seen it done. It's not the worst thing in the world, but I guess like this is a fine apology for if George never finishes it and if you want to make peace with it as a fan, but it's not like rhetorically persuasive to someone that's not coming from that like place of like I'm going to cut George some slack.
Especially when you hear everything he says about his future work, right?
Right.
The things how he's writing 13 new chapters and they'll be out by X date, and the X date comes, and it's not
right.
It's not out. I mean, he doesn't sound like a man who is trying to make a point by leaving something unfinished.
Yeah, and I mean, I agree with the whole thing that like he. Here's the thing: you're absolutely right on whether he finishes or not. He has made an important contribution to popular literature and fantasy mm-hmm. literature,
for
like,
sure.
Like probably the most significant since Lord of the Rings. But. Like, even with that admiration, there'll always be a giant fat asterisk if he doesn't finish this fucking thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that the Double D's have done in finishing themselves is shine a giant fucking spotlight on that asterisk to where the average person could be forgiven for not seeing anything but that asterisk.
Sure.
So, yeah. I mean, again, like, I'm not, you know, I got a lot of complex feelings, but I'm not, I don't have any hate for Martin. I'm disappointed. I think he's disappointed himself. I think that, like, I can't even imagine how miserable he must be on a daily basis thinking about how this opportunity has passed him by.
Mm-hmm.
And to what extent he could have presented it, I don't know. But, like, it's got to just eat him up. Like, if it was me, it would absolutely eat me up.
Maybe he doesn't care. Maybe he's just out on it by
his
pool. I don't
think that doesn't seem like it, though.
Chilling.
It seems like he takes the shit personally. And I think he should.
I'm going to give it at least a few hundred years before I start comparing him to Homer or the person who wrote Beowulf.
Homer's like, overrated.
Yeah. I don't know. I've never read.
And who knows how good Beowulf was in original English? No one can stand to read it. We're essentially like there could have been liberties. There could have been liberties in the Grendel plot.
There probably were, yeah. The TV series of Beowulf really got in the way. they were doing live action stuff back then on stage, and it was
right.
You know, he just couldn't write fast enough. The live action happened every night.
The sex position scene between Beowulf and Grendel's mom. Did we really need to see that? You know, I don't care how. Did you ever see the animated version of Beowulf?
I didn't.
It was something else.
Yeah,
it was something else. It had Crispin Glover as the screaming Grendel. It had
boy.
It had Laura, who's played Laura Croft, Angelina Jolie as Grendel's mom, as a very kind of like look just like Angelina Jolie kind of.
Really?
Kind of thing. Yeah.
Okay.
Like interesting choice, just cast a digital actor like that. Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, that's the thing where it breaks down is like. Was Homer considered Homer back in his day?
Right.
You know, like is George Martin going to be in the 500 years? Is he going to be put up with him and like Chaucer and all that stuff? Like, fuck if I know.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way to tell in the present. You have to let it stand the test of time.
People,
and
like,
if it does, that's how you point to those people and say this is seminal work.
Right. Like modern audiences tend to shit on popular literature, and then you wait 100 years or so, and then it's like, oh my God, Dickens was kind of amazing.
Yeah.
Even though his shit was the definition of like popular literature of the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Lovecraft is amazing, even though he was like a pulp fiction writer of his day. Like same thing with Edgar Allan Poe and countless examples. Jane Austen probably would be considered a bodice ripping novelist, like somebody that had Fabio on her covers in her day. And people can't fucking stop spanking themselves over her literary genius. So, and I'm not saying it's undeserved. I'm just saying it's tough to say where George's place in the pantheon is going to be.
I am comfortable with the Tolkien comparisons,
sure.
though, because he's such a recent, in the grand scheme of things, writer as well.
Yeah, like Tolkien's an example. Like he's hailed as kind of a probably because this is a fairly young genre.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a lot of like everything you see fantasy wise is all based in like kind of like a bedrock of his work.
Yeah.
And like what was before that time? Like King Arthur?
Yeah, I mean you had I guess stuff that would have been considered religions back in the day, you know, and now we consider it fantasy. Like
I guess that's true.
The Greek and mythos, that kind of stuff. Like,
right. All that was fantasy.
All that, yeah, I view as fantasy. They wouldn't have at the time though, right?
Did they? Because that's the thing I always wondered, like I mean the Greeks and Romans worshiped these as gods, like, non-ironically, but, like, mm-hmm. some of the plays and stuff, like, did they think that was actually gospel? Like, this is what really happens? Or they're like, oh, this is a story using these archetypes that we're familiar with? Like, I don't know. Like,
those gods must not be nearly as wrathful and vengeful as the Judeo-Christian gods.
Right.
Because that one, I don't think, would tolerate stage plays based on using his name with fictional happenings.
Yeah. But, you know what I'm saying? It's like one of those things where, like, there's very little, like, it's hard to find, like, verifiable historical records of stuff, let alone, like, yeah. what the fucking critics of the day were talking about, you know, plays and whatnot.
Sure.
So, anyway.
It will not be hard to find those about George Martin, though.
Yeah, I guess the end of our podcast are turning into just, like, science fiction, fantasy, literature talk. But,
that's fine.
Is it?
I think so. Fine. Yeah.
It's happening. I'm powerless to resist it. GameofThrones@baldmove.com is where you want to send email. You can also follow us simply at baldmove.com, or you can go use our social media sources, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, @or/baldmove, whichever one they require. Also, we have our forums, forums.baldmove.com, if you want to try out one of your outlandish theories there, see what the bald movers think of it.
Mm-hmm.
It is there to receive you. That's it. We'll be back for the next episode next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.